Good morning. I call the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee meeting to order on March 21st, 2023. We have a quorum present. A quorum is present. Representative Hewitt, may I have a motion to approve the minutes of March 17th, 2023?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Hewitt moves approval of the minutes for March 17th. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion prevails and the minutes of March 17th, 2023 are approved. March 17th, 2023 are approved. Okay, we have Representative Greenman in front of us with House File 2483. Our intention is to lay this bill over for possible inclusion. If you would please tell us about your bill and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning, State Government Finance members. I'm grateful to be back here to present to House File 2483, a bill to pay off the U.S. Bank Stadium and protect this important asset. This bill is part of the ongoing discussion with various stakeholders, including the city, the state, the Vikings, and MSFA, and represents what we think is a good framework grounded in our shared goals of protecting the public facility and asset of the U.S. Bank Stadium and providing savings and fairness to the state and Minneapolis taxpayers who are on the hook for the public investment made to build and operate the stadium. I should note that people were at very different places at the outset of the conversation of how the stadium will be built. 13 years ago, the decision was made and the stadium is here. It was built with tremendous public investment and effort, and it's an important facility for which our public responsibility remains. Ensuring that the stadium remains a world-class facility is an important goal that all stakeholders share. And we're in a different place now than we were 13 years ago. We're operating off of different information that we know now and things that we didn't know in 2013 when the stadium was originally passed. Specifically, because the revenue in the stadium reserve account has outperformed expectations, we're in a position to pay back the construction bonds early and to save taxpayers significant money on debt service, estimated around $225-$250 million of what is in the stadium reserve to defease the construction bonds nearly 20 years early. As part of this conversation, it's also important to note that although this is the primary obligation the state has to the stadium, the construction bonds are just one of several sources of public taxpayer money going into the stadium. In addition to their share of the debt service on the construction bonds and the repayment of the state advance, the state is retaining taxes from the city of Minneapolis for three additional stadium obligations through 2046, paying into the capital improvement reserve, the operating account, and directly to the MSFA with a little known and murky provision that captures a portion of the city's growth without detail on the statutory purpose and the statutory other than it says in statute for the benefit of the Minnesota Sports Facility Authority. Even after the construction bonds are defeased, the city of Minneapolis and the Vikings will continue to pay millions each year to operate and improve the stadium. And both have expressed the concerns that there are insufficient resources at this point in the capital improvement account necessary to keep the stadium a world-class facility. This bill in front of you takes a holistic approach and looks at how we can be the best stewards of public dollars to maintain, operate, and improve the U.S. Bank Stadium. It does three main things. It uses funds from the stadium reserve account to defease the stadium construction bonds. Once the bonds are defeased, it relieves the city of Minneapolis of having to continue to pay debt service payments on bonds that no longer exist. It also addresses the needs identified by the city, by the Vikings, and by MSFA to increase resources available for the capital improvement reserve. All three parties have identified that the framework of the original deal is likely insufficient to fund the capital upgrades necessary to keep the stadium a world-class facility as required. What this bill does is it says the city of Minneapolis has made a commitment to increase and propose to increase their contribution to the capital improvement reserve, which is now at about $1.7 million, and they would increase it to $5 million a year. It also keeps with the original structure of the deal, ask the Vikings to match that City of Minneapolis increase and uphold the parity that's in the original deal between the Vikings and the city moving into the capital reserve account. The last thing it does is it eliminates the city taxes captured for the benefit of the Minneapolis, of the Minnesota Sports Facility Association, also referred to as Purpose 5. This tax for the benefit of MSFA provision has a mysterious origin, and it's not known or well understood even by the people who worked on this deal 13 years ago. There's not definition for what the funds are for its purposes, and it has not been well articulated or clear how it's being used. It will cost the city over $250 million over the course of the deal. It's expensive, unnecessary, and should be repealed. Lastly, I would note that this bill is intentionally silent on the future of charitable gambling revenue and the stadium reserve account. That is a different conversation for a different committee and a different day. It does say if the revenue continues, the bill provides a hierarchy, if you will, of how the revenue would flow with the gambling proceeds, but only if they continue to flow. This bill reflects the goals of protecting and investing in a stadium to make it ensure that it's world-class asset to the state and to the city and to the folks in Minnesota, and to be a good steward to taxpayer contributions and the public investment used to build, operate, and improve the stadium. With that, Madam Chair, we have a few testifiers from Minneapolis and I think the Vikings.
Thank you very much. Would you like to begin with Andrew Johnson?
Thank you, Madam Chair, I would. Mm-hmm.
Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Andrew Johnson. I'm a Minneapolis City Council member and the chair of the Intergovernmental Relations for the City of Minneapolis. I want to thank you, Chair Cleavorn, and committee members today for hearing this bill and allowing us to testify. Minneapolis is proud to host the U.S. Bank Stadium in our city. It brings activity to downtown, it brings in visitors from across the state, across the country, and provides immense value for the state of Minnesota as a statewide asset and value as well to the city of Minneapolis. We are committed as a city to ensuring that this remains a world-class facility in partnership with you all, the state, and the Vikings. This committee's previously discussed the topic of retiring the debt for the U.S. Bank Stadium construction bonds early using the stadium reserve. We wholeheartedly agree that early retirement of the bonds is an idea that makes sense. It'll save taxpayers throughout the state millions of dollars. According to MMB, the bonds will save $226 million. However, without any changes to the current statute, Minneapolis will make an estimated $1 billion, $1 billion in payment towards construction, operations, and maintenance of the stadium. Nearly $2,500 per capita for every man, woman, and child in the city. And we will not share in any of the savings from early payoffs of the bonds. Representative Greenman's bill, thank you for bringing this bill forward, will address this by making changes to ensure that Minneapolis fairly shares in these benefits with all stadium partners, the state and the Vikings. We are grateful for the opportunity to share more about the city's perspective on this important topic, and the city's chief operations officer will go into more details on specific aspects of the bill that the city supports. Again, thank you for the opportunity today, and we look forward to collaborating with you on a fair proposal on the stadium that benefits all partners while maintaining this important statewide asset for the long term.
Thank you, Councilmember Johnson. We appreciate your testimony and for being here today. Heather Johnston. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Cleavorn and committee members. I'm Heather Johnston, Interim City Operations Officer for the City of Minneapolis. I'm pleased to be here to provide some more perspective on this important topic. And thank you to Representative Greenman for her interest in engagement on this as well. There is or will soon be sufficient lawful gaming tax revenue in the stadium reserve to pay off the entire public investment in the stadium construction. And we support that happening. However, we also support the provision of this bill that eliminates the requirement that the City of Minneapolis continues to make debt service payments on the bond after the bonds are repaid. As Councilmember Johnson noted, The city has significant obligations to the stadium beyond just the construction expense. The handout before you, looks like this, illustrates our projections of the costs and purposes, which are funded by local sales tax, including our downtown restaurant tax and liquor taxes, and importantly, citywide lodging and sales taxes. We support the provisions of Representative Greenman's bill that revisit the original formulas relating to ongoing city obligations in order to ensure that we strike the right balance to support critical capital and operating needs of the stadium while also having sufficient resources to support the cities and as a net contributor of tax revenue to the state, the entire region's ongoing economic recovery. We look forward to additional discussions on the stadium and working with the various bill authors, the Minneapolis delegation, the state of Minnesota, and the Vikings to address the statute to address these additional concerns. Thank you for your work on this topic and on many others of importance to the state. Appreciate your time.
Thank you very much, Operations Officer Johnston. We appreciate your testimony today. Next, we have Lester Bagley, Executive Vice President for the Vikings. If you please state your name for the record and begin your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. Lester Bagley, I'm Executive Vice President of Public Affairs for the Minnesota Vikings. Appreciate the opportunity to testify today, be here to comment on the Vikings' positions or thoughts on the legislation that would pay off U.S. Bank Stadium. First, we're grateful to Governor Walz for his proposal to pay off U.S. Bank Stadium 20 years in advance. We agree that it's fiscally prudent and it would be a great benefit to Minnesota taxpayers. U.S. Bank Stadium has been a tremendous success story, paying the building off 20 years in advance and saving taxpayers literally hundreds of millions of dollars. It would be a continuation of that great success. We're also grateful to the bill authors of the original stadium agreement in 2012 who had the foresight to ensure that our lease or use agreement requires significant obligations from the Vikings, but also requires the Minnesota Sports Facilities Authority to operate and maintain U.S. Bank Stadium in a first-class manner similar to and consistent with other comparable NFL stadiums. As a reminder, as part of our 2012 stadium agreements, the Vikings and private sources invested more than $610 million up front to construct the stadium. In addition to the $477 million that was part of the legislation, the Will family and the Vikings added an additional $135 million on top of the $477 that we made these financial agreements with the state of Minnesota and the city of Minneapolis. As part of the 2012 legislation and in addition to the $610 million up front, the Vikings agreed to pay the highest rent in the NFL at $8.5 million each year, increasing annually by 3%. That amount now is $10.2 million. The Vikings paid $10.2 million in rent in 2022. In addition, the Vikings agreed to pay $1.5 million annually for capital reserve contribution, which also grows at 3% annually. The total paid by the Vikings in 2022 was $1.8 million. The Vikings are also responsible for all of our game day expenses, which were $6.5 million in 2022. In exchange for these agreements and financial commitments from the team, the state and the city of Minneapolis made a number of commitments and have obligations to the facility as well. We are appreciative of the legislators who have brought forth proposals to pay off U.S. Bank Stadium. We have a couple of thoughts and recommendations or principles on stadium payoff legislation that any legislation that moves forward, if you would. We appreciate our partnership with the state of Minnesota and the city of Minneapolis. Together, we created an amazing facility. The Vikings are neutral on how the state and the city determine how to pay off that stadium and who benefits from that payoff as the public share was funded by the state and the city. So we're neutral on how that is sorted out. Two, we would have serious concerns about any provision that attempts to change the terms of the contract that we agreed to in 2012 with respect to future annual capital improvements or operating payments. Those items were agreed to after significant negotiation, and attempts to unilaterally impose new terms would be problematic. And third, we strongly believe that the governor and the legislature should pivot on the robust electronic poll tab collections and use a portion of these funds going forward to fund the long-term capital needs of U.S. Bank Stadium. Electronic poll tabs were created and legalized for this purpose, to fund U.S. Bank Stadium. We think it's prudent to follow through on that directive and use a portion of these ongoing proceeds to protect this amazing asset. We just finished our seventh NFL season in U.S. Bank Stadium, already 7 years under our belt. The MSFA has created a, or undertaken a, some work with a stadium designer, Populous, on a stadium master plan to account for the significant improvements and system replacements that are coming due in the not so distant future at the stadium. We look forward to the completion of this MSFA study that will help inform the public on the level of future capital investment that will be required and that will keep up U.S. Bank Stadium in a first-class manner.
Mr. Bagley, are you about to wrap up?
Yeah, just last couple points here. Thank you, Madam Chair. We believe this is the finest stadium in the National Football League and one of the finest venues in the world. It's been a great asset to the state of Minnesota, the city of Minneapolis, our community, and to Viking fans as it delivers an amazing fan experience. U.S. Bank Stadium has an been an economic success, being a major catalyst for development downtown East Minneapolis. And during in 2022, U.S. Bank Stadium delivered more than 1 million visitors who generate tax receipts and income to the public and private sectors. It has delivered incredibly impactful national events like Super Bowl, NCAA Final Four, X Games, and many others, all of which provide significant economic impact and strengthen our brand as a state. So thank you, Madam Chair. The Vikings are supportive of legislation that would allow for the stadium bonds to be retired. We look forward to being part of a constructive part of the conversation and discussions that go forward. We also look forward to further discussions about the opportunity to address the long-term capital needs of U.S. Bank Stadium.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate it. I see no amendments to the bill. Okay, and with that, then we can move to member discussion. Sir, Lead Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the author. On line 4.10 through 4.11, you've got a blank appropriation, and I forgot my dots in my office, or I would have brought them for you. But can you tell us why there's a blank appropriation on that line?
Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Nash. And this is the provision that I said was basically a hierarchy. If there continues to be, if the decision is made that there continues to be money in the stadium reserve account, that after paying off the bonds, we'll make a transfer to the capital reserve fund. We haven't made that decision yet as a legislature, and that's why I didn't feel comfortable putting in a number. I think that this is likely to go in an omnibus bill, and that's probably along with a different conversation where that will be decided.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just comment briefly. I am a co-author on the first bill that we heard, and I believe that that is a better approach. I believe that we do have a need to continue the long-term capital operations, operational operations, and paying off the debt certainly is important. I think in part and parcel we agree, but I also think that it's important that as we as legislators work with stakeholders, that we make sure that we're listening fully to the stakeholders. And we just heard, I think, I don't want to characterize the words, but I don't know that this approach is as warmly received as other pieces of legislation moving through. And I think it's important that we do work on that. I know that Representative Nelson has worked with all the stakeholders, and I think that that is probably a little better and more balanced bill for the approach at hand. So while we are not going to be voting on this today, I will not be supporting this effort. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nadeau. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Freeman. Representative Nadeau, so come forward with your question.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Greenman. So we're going to your bill, and I agree with Representative Nash. The Representative Nelson's bill basically, and I think everyone here agrees that having the ability to pay off these bonds early saves the state of Minnesota a lot of money. The thing that I'm having a problem with in House File 2483 is that, you know, the city of Minneapolis came to the, you know, came to the original negotiations in this thing, and they haven't even started paying off their obligation. I mean, I think it was 2021 they made their first payment. Tell me why you think that we should forgive an original partner from their obligation in building this facility. I can't get my head wrapped around that.
Thank you, Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Nadeau, and also Representative Nash. I just wanted to say I agree with you that the stakeholders need to be consulted and agree to this. I think if you remember the last bill we heard, the city of Minneapolis actually testified against it. So when we're talking about stakeholder engagement, I have spent a lot of time with a lot of the stakeholders, and we know that the deal that we have to get to represents all of those stakeholders, not just some. And this is an attempt to continue that conversation. As it relates to the city of Minneapolis and the original obligation, I think we know things now that we didn't know then, and it is our job in 2023 to actually be good stewards of both the facility. What we're hearing from MSFA, from the Vikings, and the city of Minneapolis is that we actually need to think seriously about the capital reserve account, that the money, the original deal, and the way that was funded is not enough. I think you heard that from the Vikings. I think you heard that from Minneapolis. And so we have, as a legislature, the question is for state, but certainly the question I know that's on the city of Minneapolis's mind, and I'm sure the Vikings, is how do we ensure that we have the capital reserve that we need to continue and to do what I think Mr. Bagley referred to as the master plan, what MSFA has been talking about. The reason we don't yet know how much we need in the capital reserve account in those dot, dot, dots is that MSFA is currently going through this process, and we've been waiting for the number. We've been talking about with them for about 2 months on that. And the other thing I would say, it is our obligation to be good stewards of the information we have now. It doesn't make sense to require a stakeholder to pay debt on bonds that no longer exist. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. Representative Nadeau, follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, and I think that's great that the debt no longer exists. But you know, there's a partner in here that hasn't paid their fair share. So tell me where the equity is there. We can talk about the ongoing capital problem that we're going to have to make sure that we keep this facility. But you know what this bill right here does? It basically forgives a bunch of debt for one of the partners that agreed to this in the first case. And the second thing that it does is it basically puts, more obligations on the state and the team to basically come up with more money to fund, in the future. So tell me how that works. It just doesn't work. And I'll stop after this. But I'm obviously not going to support this bill. The Representative Nelson's bill is more straightforward. It allows us to work forward and actually figure out a better way to do it, rather than just this knee-jerk reaction that once the debt's gone, then no one's obligated to pay because the state of Minnesota borrowed the money to the city to begin with. So,
thank you, Representative Nadeau and Representative Greenman. I'm going to ask you to keep your response short, because we do have several other bills to move on, and we are laying this over so conversations can continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Nadeau. I think you actually mischaracterized what this bill does, because once the state pays down the bonds, they're out of the deal. And so what it means, though, is the city of Minneapolis and the Vikings, frankly, continue to pay until 2046. There are four other obligations other than construction bonds that the city of Minneapolis has to pay, and three of them, other than this tax for the benefit of MSFA, that even the original folks who were involved in the deal can't tell when that ended up in the deal or what it's for, but the city of Minneapolis actually proposed to increase the revenue that they're spending and giving to the capital reserve account, because that's where the need is. They're continuing to pay on the operating reserve account, and if you look at the handout that you have, That is a significant amount of money, $294 million for operating reserves, $73 million for capital improvement accounts, $66 million for repaying the advances, and $235 million for the MSFA. So I don't think it's fair to I think it mischaracterizes the bill. I'd also say if Minneapolis continues to pay after the bonds have been, and I think this came up in the Senate, after the bonds have been defeased, it'll actually change the proportion of the deal, and Minneapolis will end up paying closer to 50%. As opposed to, I think, the original deal, which was 70-30. So with that, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. And I see no further discussion on the bill, so we will lay it over for possible inclusion. Thank you for being here today and for presenting the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And thank you to your testifiers. Next, we will move on to Representative Frazier, House File 855. Welcome to the committee, Representative Frazier. Since you're not a member of the committee, I will move that House File 855 be re-referred to Public Safety, Finance, and the Policy Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
If you would like to present your bill.
Yes, and I'll be brief. 855, I don't think you'll have the most recent version of this bill. Many of the community grants were pulled out. They're now in House File 855. House File 25, but I'm here today on two issues, and I believe it's the Public Safety Innovation Board and the Civilian Review Board are before you all. The Public Safety Innovation Board was an idea that was crafted last year to provide a board in the office of OJP to essentially have professionals from the academic realm and also from public safety, and also include public safety stakeholders to be innovative in terms of looking at crime trends, prevention and intervention trends, and to provide best practices and engage with community organizations and law enforcement professionals to provide the best programs possible for the state of Minnesota to ensure that we have safe communities. We are still in constant conversations with the Department of Public Safety and OJP to figure out the best craft for that. So this will be an ongoing conversation, which is why this bill will be laid over in public safety to continue those conversations. I do have Director Kate Weeks here for any, if you have any specific questions for OJP around this. And then one of the reasons we're really looking to kind of also beef up the capacity for OJP is that what we learned is that there was a huge infusion of federal dollars during the pandemic. But what happened was, with the organizations that typically apply for these grants, they also had a lot of burnout because of the pandemic, and they didn't have the capacity to apply for the grants or to bring those resources in to use them to do the good work that they do in our community. So we're going to provide capacity to OJP to help those grantees to ensure they have that capacity. Also, in light of the most recent auditor report around our nonprofits and the way we deal with the resources that we put out, we want to make sure that we have the capacity there to ensure compliance, to ensure accountability, and also to ensure robust evaluation of these programs. So a lot of detail there about how we're trying to ensure that we have doing what's best for the state of Minnesota and being great stewards of the resources that we have from our taxpayer dollars. And the Civilian Review Board is pretty straightforward and simple. It is giving back the authority to local jurisdictions that was taken away several years ago, and giving them the ability to establish civilian review boards that will have power to conduct investigations and produce facts and findings in conjunction with law enforcement. And that is it.
Okay, and that language is permissive, is that
correct? Language is permissive.
All right, thank you. I appreciate your bringing the bill before us. Members, I don't see any amendments, is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay, so we'll move on to member questions, if that's all right.
We have one testifier here.
All right.
That's all right.
Welcome to the committee. I've always appreciated your testimony when I served on public safety.
Goodness gracious. Sorry about this.
That's all right.
Wayward chair. My apologies.
If you'll state your name for the record and begin your testimony, please.
Thank you, Chair Cleaver and members. My name is Michelle Gross, and I am the president of the organization Communities United Against Police Brutality. We are an organization in our 23rd year, And I want to just mention that previously I have served as the chair of the Civilian Review Authority redesign for the city of Minneapolis, and have done a lot of work on civilian oversight over the years, such that I am actually brought in sometimes by municipalities to discuss civilian oversight. What I think is important about this bill is that it is permissive. And so law enforcement, you know, often states that their goal is to improve trust between members of the community and law enforcement, and that's a lofty goal. It's a great goal. And it's best served when agencies are willing to meet community standards for how they wish to be policed and by the transparency afforded by a civilian oversight body. The language in House File 855 states that communities may create civilian oversight councils and may grant them certain powers. During prior testimony, you know, representatives of outstate communities have said at times that they don't have problems in their communities, and that's great. But, you know, and that means that those communities would probably choose not to set up a civilian oversight body. But in the community that I live in, which is Minneapolis, there have been problems, and we have to be realistic about those problems. And people in my community are eager to have the opportunity to make real civilian oversight that will allow them to make findings of fact and actually truly investigate cases. And so this just gives us the opportunity to do what we need to do in our community, and it doesn't change anything for those communities where there isn't an issue. And so those are important. There are no statutes in Minnesota that prevent communities from enacting, say, a firefighter oversight body, an ambulance oversight body, even a librarian oversight body, if that's something they choose to do. This bill simply levels the playing field. It means that all of the communities can decide for themselves what kinds of oversight they wish to have for the services that are provided to them by their governments. In 2012, civilian oversight bodies were stripped of the ability to operate effectively as a check and balance against police misconduct. Had these bodies been given that adequate power to truly serve an oversight function, it is unlikely that former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, with his 26 civilian complaints and 4 prior deadly force incidents, would have remained an employee of the city of Minneapolis long enough to have had his 5th deadly force encounter with George Floyd. Thus, I urge you to approve House File 855. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for being here and for your testimony. Member questions? Lead Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to make sure I heard the author correctly, that this is not the actual engrossment that you're working from. So we're referring something back that we don't actually have possession of the appropriate copy.
Well, I can. Sorry.
Through the chair, if you would.
That's all right. Representative Frazier.
Madam Chair, Representative Nash, the only changes in this would be the fact that these grants that are in here are no longer a part of the bill. The Civilian Review Board piece is the same. The Innovation Board, that language is the same.
I would like to clarify, Mr. Gehring tells me that we have the proper engrossment.
Well, Madam Chair, I'd like to get clarification on that, because the author himself said that this is not the same, and yet we're being asked to send something back to committee that is, by the author's admission, not the correct engrossment.
Mr. Gehring.
Madam Chair, Representative Nash, I can't speak to what Representative Frazier is referencing, but the specific bill draft that's in front of the committee, House File 855, is referred and is in the possession of State Government Finance.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I can clear it.
We'll move to Representative Nadeau. Your question, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Frazier. This in section, basically, I think it's Article 1, Section 1, the Public Safety Innovation Board. I mean, this is very similar to what it's kind of a CJCC component that has been really successful in Hennepin County, where all law enforcement partners, public defenders, courts, you know, the criminal justice partners come together and really do try to find those areas of efficiency. You know, this is where electronic filing came from CJCC. So there's, I think there's real value in Section 1. My concern, and thank you for talking with me yesterday about your bill, I really appreciate it. My concern is that having a statewide approach, we might lose that. Criminal justice is really parochial, I guess. And I'm worried that it will, not displace CJCC or the opportunity for that, but I'm worried that it will overshadow, become more important, and not meet those individual communities where they are. Can you talk to me a little bit? I know that I'm out there vague a little bit. I'm really worried that this is going to take away. This is going to take away from local jurisdictions' ability, not ability to collaborate, but overshadow and have more focus on a state program. Then we'll start trying to, you know, apply for grants to fund, you know, and it has a tendency to move away from that, the lowest level. And I want to make sure that, I know that that wouldn't be your intent, but I want to make sure that this is not going to get in the way.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Nadeau, thank you. And I often forget how much time you spent in Hennepin County, so I appreciate your perspective. That is absolutely not the intent. So I can assure you that, and I can assure you that in conversations with OJP, it is not their intent to take over any of the local entities that have these type of organizations in place now to make sure they are having the types of efficiencies and effective work in their communities. And that would be important for me as I work closely with the Hennepin County Commission to ensure that we have what's necessary for our communities to keep our communities safe. I wouldn't want to impede on that at all. So I can guarantee you that that is not the intent of this. And in fact, the idea is that we can find more resources so that our local county commissioners in those entities that are collaborating together will have the ability to apply for those resources, to bring more resources to their communities, to implement more programs that they are being innovative about to make sure that we can resource them well. So that's the plan.
Thank you. One follow-up. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be done. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Yes, Madam Chair. I know a number of groups are in opposition to this. I know this gives some fairly wide authority to the citizen oversight groups. I think they have subpoena power and some other things that they've been granted. I do think this is a little bit heavy-handed, and you're making a referral back to the committee, and I'm going to ask for a roll call on that re-referral.
A roll call has been requested. Representative Frazier, do you want to comment before? How about if you close up your bill and then we'll do the roll call.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a bill that has been worked on closely with many stakeholders. We're trying to strike a fair balance, in regards to the civilian review boards. We are returning power that was taken away by the legislators. So you talk about local authority and local power. We're giving that back. Representative Nash, I know you were a former mayor. You'd want that back. So thank you for that. So we're giving that power back. We'll continue to work with those stakeholders to try to figure out something fair and balanced. And we just want to make sure we're doing what's best for our communities to keep them safe.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 855 be re-referred to the Public Safety, Finance, and Policy Committee. And with that, will you please take the roll?
Chair Cleavorn?
Aye.
Chair Cleavorn? Aye. Vice Chair Hewitt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hewitt? Aye. Representative Nash?
No.
Representative Nash? No. Representative Bonner?
Aye.
Representative Bonner? Aye. Representative Freiberg?
Yes.
Representative Freiberg? Aye. Representative Hansen?
Aye.
Representative Hansen? Aye. Representative Harder?
No.
Representative Harder? No. Representative Herr?
Aye.
Representative Herr? Aye. Representative Joy? Representative Joy, no. Representative Kosnick,
no.
Representative Kosnick, no. Representative Nadeau,
no.
Representative Nadeau, no. Representative Newton,
aye.
Representative Newton, aye. The ayes are 7, the nays are 5, and 1 excused.
With 7 ayes, 5 nays, 1 excused, the motion prevails, and House File 855 is re-referred to the Public Safety, Finance, and Policy Committee. Thank you, Representative Frazier. Next on our agenda today, we have House File 2250, Representative Newton. Representative Newton, you are on the committee, and so it is our intention to lay this bill over for possible inclusion. If you would please present the bill.
Yep, thank you, Madam Chair. House File 2250 is a bill for $850,000 to do upgrades on a portion of the roof at the National Sports Center Ice Arena. This roof is the back portion of the arena. There are two sections there. The front portion was damaged, and that covers four of the ice sheets. And as a result of the damage, the roof has to be repaired. So our timing is such that we want to install solar on the back portion of the arena, but we need to upgrade the roof and to do it at the same time that we're repairing the front portion of the roof. With me, I have Neil Ladd, who's the Deputy Executive Director for the Sports Center, and I would like to turn testimony over to him.
Thank you very much, and welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Neil Ladd, Director, Deputy Exec Director for the National Sports Center and the Amateur Sports Commission. Just real quickly, this was a part of an original ask of $5 million from the RDF funds, and the infrastructure for that RDF fund request was subtracted off. So it was $5 million minus the roof repair, which is the $850, which is in the House File 2250 before you today. It's a non-energy, non-related expense, and so we subtracted it off there and put it in here. One of the things that I think is really interesting about this is the National Sports Center is very innovative as it comes to energy. If you think about our largest cost at the National Sports Center, over $1 million is spent on energy alone. So we're trying to do our best with state taxpayers' dollars. We have six electric Zambonis. We have over 100 electric golf carts. So this would be a great fit to reduce some of those energy-related costs and get, you know, more bang for the buck, so to speak, for the taxpayers of the state of Minnesota.
Thank you. Whenever people use abbreviations, I just ask them to please state what the abbreviation means. You used RDF.
Renewable Development Fund, sorry.
Thank you very much. All right. Members, I see no amendments to this bill. Is there any member discussion? Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. RDF refused to fund it because it didn't meet their scope for the structural improvements to hold the solar panels. Is that the case? Why did they cut out the 855 or 850?
Madam Chair, the original request, Representative Nadeau, was for $5 million
yep.
to the Energy Committee, and that included the upgrade of the roof. And because the upgrade isn't a portion of, it isn't something that the RDA would cover, that bill is still before them for $4,150,000.
So it's a substructure question. Is that what I'm asking? What you're answering? Okay. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So it was an ineligible cost reimbursement from the RDF fund. That was the only thing I was getting at. If they could have funded it, I'm assuming they would have. Correct?
Yes, but they, you know, it's not a part of what is normally considered energy.
Yep.
You know, because it's the upgrading of the roof.
Thank you very much. One follow-up.
Yep. And what are the calculated energy savings that this will, that this total installation will provide, including, I mean, if you can give me a basic year return on investment, including the $850,000, that would be great.
Mr. Ladd.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. This will reduce the energy cost by about 20%, up to about 20% for the National Sports Center.
Thank you.
And their costs, Madam Chair,
Representative Newton.
Their annual costs are close to $1 million right now. So the estimated savings is in the neighborhood of $200,000 a year.
And the return on investment? So what's the payoff? I don't know what the solar installation is. I mean, if it's $5 million, I was just wondering the payoff.
The bill before us is for $850,000. Mr. Ladd, do you have an answer for that, or maybe a break-even point?
Madam Chair, members, less than 20 years.
Thank you very much. Lead Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the author. Mr. Ladd talked about a lot of different forms of energy. What form of energy do they use at the National Sports Center to cut their grass?
Mr. Ladd.
I'm still hoping, Representative Nash, that you'll get on my bill for electric lawnmowers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That was tongue-in-cheek to bring a little levity to the committee. But I would like a firmer number, as Representative Nadeau was leaning towards, as to the actual ROI of this effort. You know, solar panels have a shelf life, and if we're going to make an investment in really a worthy facility, it would be nice to know that there is a payoff that can be measured in actual benefit, because they do have a usable life, and if the usable life of those is actually less than the rate of return, then that's troubling. So I don't know where this bill is. This being laid over, or
the bill is being laid over, and the bill itself is for the basic repair of the roof. It is not for the solar panels. I know you understand that, but we can ask for the information to be provided to the committee.
Well, Madam Chair, I would direct your attention to line 1.9 at the end of the line. It is talking directly about solar panels in the bill, so I think it's germane to the question. Germane to the bill, so it would be nice to be able to get that number. And this is not adversarial, Madam Chair. This is a facility that, as you've heard me say on Friday of last week, I support them, but yeah, it's in the bill, so it would be nice to figure out what that measurement is.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, if I might add, the estimated payoff period is between 20 and 25 years, depending on electric costs. You know, some of those things will vary over time.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Representative Joy, normally we end with Lead Nash. One question, please.
I think the average life of a solar panel is, what, 25 to 30 years is what they estimate? Okay. So 20 years payoff. So. Thank you.
Thank you. And we will conclude there and lay this bill over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Newton and Mr. Ladd, for being with us today. Our next bill up is House File 1859, Representative Feist. Welcome to the committee, Representative Feist.
Thank you. One of my testifiers is on his way from a kitty doctor appointment. We have another testifier as well.
Are you comfortable with beginning?
Yeah.
All right. Representative Feist, since you're not a member of the committee, I will re-refer House File 1859, be re-referred to Ways and Means Committee. And with that, if you will please explain your bill.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee. And did you want to start with the amendment or afterwards?
We can begin with the A3. Mm-hmm. Okay. I will move that the A3 to House File 1859 be before the committee. To your amendment.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. This just strikes language referring to the Attorney General's office because they already have that power, so it was just redundant language. It doesn't actually change anything substantive.
Thank you very much. Is there any discussion to the A3? Seeing none, all those in favor of the adoption say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion prevails and the A3 is adopted. To your bill, 1859, as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee. This bill is to address wage theft in the construction industry. 1 in 5 construction workers in Minnesota is likely to experience being misclassified, paid off the books, and or having their wages stolen. In 2019, we passed a wage theft law that was a step in the right direction, but it has not addressed this issue, and it remains very prevalent. Under this bill, construction contractors and project owners engaging in subcontracting of labor on their construction projects are liable for unpaid wages and damages stemming therefrom of the subcontractors performing work under their control. Notably, this bill provides more tools to enable general contractors to prevent wage theft by requiring that contractors are entitled to a variety of information about the payroll practices of their subcontractors so they can prevent those subcontractors from violating the Act and thereby preventing more violations of the Act and avoiding liability. This will ensure that the construction workers subjected to wage theft have recourse to collect unpaid wages from contractors and to incentivize the hiring of responsible contractors by placing the responsibility to prevent wage theft on those with the most control over the construction labor practices. This bill is well designed. The burden should be on the person who has the most control rather than the one who has the least control. And I would like to mention that we are working on an amendment, continuing to have conversations with stakeholders. We're going to add some clarification on what timely notice is. We're going to eliminate some language about general contractors being able to withhold payment, because I know that is a concern. We're also looking at providing procedural clarity on the process as between generals and subcontractors. And the reason we're here in this committee is because there are provisions relating to the Department of Labor and Industry and also the Attorney General's Office.
Thank you very much. And you have testifiers with you today. If you'd like to state your name for the record and begin your testimony, please.
Thank you, Representative Claiborne, Chair. My name is Kevin Pranis, and I'm here on behalf of Liuna, Minnesota, North Dakota.
Thank you. And your testimony, please.
Thank you. We appreciate Representative Feist bringing this bill forward. I think that a lot of the work has been done by the Carpenters Union. Our union is fully in support of this and appreciates their efforts. The Carpenters have been a real leader on the issue of preventing wage theft, which is endemic in Minnesota. The surveys suggest that I believe the number is about, you know, a fifth or a quarter of construction workers are experiencing wage theft. This is incredibly widespread. For those not familiar with construction, it may be hard to believe, but in the construction industry, it's quite common for workers to be paid off the books or to be told that they need to be independent contractors to avoid tax liability, to avoid workers' compensation and insurance liability that affects all taxpayers. I think the relevant issue with the bill for this committee is that it is simply not feasible, nor is it reasonable to expect the taxpayers to fund what the industry should be doing to police itself. Right now, the Department of Labor and Industry, we support the hiring of additional investigators, but the truth is that it would take an army of 500 or 1,000 investigators to be on construction sites on a regular basis to talk to workers, to document the cases of wage theft. I mean, our staff of other building trades, can't even keep up with the number of cases, right? There's a bottleneck in terms of prosecuting those. And the truth is that general contractors could solve all of these problems because they're in the best position. They both have all the information needed and can access all the information needed to know if workers are being paid correctly. And they have all of the power and authority needed to ensure that their contractors are following the law. And I would just cite a couple of examples where we found that the buck stops nowhere in construction. One, if you look at the DigiKey project, there was a major state investment in the DigiKey project in Thief River Falls. We discovered by talking to workers that there are workers who were being paid a fraction of what they should have been earning on that project, which was supposed to be covered by prevailing wage rates. Not only were there huge underpayments that resulted ultimately in over $300,000 in payments from the contractor for more than a year's worth of work for dozens of workers, but after the problem was brought to the attention of the general contractor and the project owner, the underpayments continued for months, 6 or 8 months after it was made public. And the reason is the general contractor had no incentive to fix the problem. Instead, they said, well, it sounds like a question for labor and industry. So taxpayer dollars are spent for an investigation that lasted, you know, maybe 6 or 8 months to document these underpayments and resulting in these workers finally getting their money back, instead of the general contractor stepping up, taking responsibility, and fixing the problem going forward. Similarly, we had a case where a very large area retailer, acting as its own general contractor, hired a subcontractor who, according to sworn testimony from workers, engaged in widespread wage theft, including, in this case, a worker who was never paid at all for his work, worked there for about 2 weeks, quit because the conditions were unacceptable, and the contractor refused to pay him and then said that they would only pay him if he agreed to falsely file as an independent contractor because they had never signed him up on payroll to begin with. And despite that, 6 months later, this worker is still not paid. This was brought to the attention of the large retailer, large and well-known retailer that was responsible for the project. And again, it still took another 6 months for that worker to get paid because the general contractor had no incentive to resolve the situation because the buck stops nowhere in construction. And so we strongly support this bill. We think it's reasonable. And this will reduce both, bring more money in terms of the taxes that contractors should be paying on the workers that are being misclassified. And it would also reduce the need to spend significant taxpayer sums chasing after contractors that the general contractor in charge of the project should be taking responsibility for. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pranis, for your testimony. Next, we have Adam Dunick. If you'd please state your name for the record and begin your testimony, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Adam Dunick. I'm here. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the North Central States Regional Council of Carpenters. Thanks for the opportunity to present this morning. Representative Feist did an outstanding job explaining what the bill is and what it does. Mr. Pranis from Liuna did a great job of explaining why it's so needed and why we support it. I just want to add, I guess, another word or two about that. Because some might be asking themselves, why are we still working on the issue of wage theft after we passed a really big bill in 2019? Well, the reason is that bill isn't working for workers in construction. It mostly isn't working for workers in construction because their direct employer usually controls a lot about their life that they don't have a lot to say about. And so they have to navigate a complicated web of who their real employer is. They have to navigate sometimes a complicated web of how to file a complaint and work that through a process through the Department of Labor and Industry. And we think that this bill will ultimately lead to better outcomes for workers, and it will clarify the chain of command as some of the points that Kevin just made in his testimony. The status quo just isn't working. And this bill is about workers. I just want to reiterate that. We had great testimony in other committees from workers. We're not bringing them to every committee, but if you had taken a listen to what you heard from workers in the labor committees in the House and Senate, it's pretty heartbreaking stuff that they had to talk about. And I give them a lot of credit for having the courage to step forward. There was also an article in the newspaper this past, a little over a week ago, that summarized that. So I'll use their own words. We want justice. We want a system that works for us. Lastly, I just want to thank Representative Feist for her great work on this bill and bringing people together. We have made this bill better. We've made some amendments along the way. We're still working on one with some subcontractors that I think will tighten up some language as well. I'm happy to answer questions and be around as a resource, but thanks for the opportunity to say a few words this morning, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Donick. We appreciate you being with us. Next, we will have Brian Dahl. Brian Dahl. He doesn't appear to be with us at this moment. Peter Coyle.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Peter Coyle. I'm the legislative counsel to the Housing First Minnesota. Housing First Minnesota is the state's largest trade association dedicated to the housing industry, its builders, its suppliers, and its subcontractors. Let me start by acknowledging the effort of Representative Feist and thanking her for meeting with us a few weeks back to share with her our concerns about the bill and why we continue to object to the bill. And the reasons are really quite simple. We acknowledge that there are individuals who've been harmed through wage theft, and I listened to the testimony that's been referenced, and those claims are genuine and they are worthy of response by the Department of Labor and Industry. But that's the first point. I've participated in multiple hearings on this bill, and not once has the Department of Labor and Industry itself or the Attorney General's office been present and testified that there's a problem. We passed a very aggressive wage theft law in 3 years ago, and those agencies have that authority to enforce those restrictions, and yet none of them are here today asking for passage of this bill. Our second concern is that Minnesota is already an outlier as a high-cost state for the construction of housing. In our opinion, this bill will make it worse, and it's not something that we think the state should be doing at this time. The law sets out a very complicated and expensive regulatory scheme whereby general contractors have to now be responsible for the activities of their subcontractors who are legally independent companies. The generals do not have control over hiring. They do not have control over payment of wages. And therefore, we think that that cost burden, if you will, is going to be forced onto the general contractors, particularly smaller ones, who are not well equipped to implement the law. And the ultimate effect is that it's going to make housing that much more expensive and make Minnesota that much more of an outlier. So for those reasons, Madam Chair and members of the committee, we urge that the committee not adopt the bill in its current form. Happy to take questions if you have any for me. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Coyle. And next we will have Brooke Brodson. Thank you. With the League of Minnesota Cities. Thank you for being with us. If you'll state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Cleavorn and members. Thanks for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Brooke Brodson, and I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities, which represents 837 cities across the state. And I'll just briefly touch on a concern related to municipal contracting in cities. Under the new definitions in the bill, starting on line 3.25, a city as a project owner could be deemed a contractor in certain circumstances and liable for all claims as such. Because public projects are funded with taxpayer dollars, municipalities as project owners are subject to unique requirements under the state's Uniform Municipal Contracting Law, and other statutes. Competitive bidding laws exist to ensure taxpayers get the best obtainable price, to level the playing field for contractors to win public contracts, and to limit the discretion of officials to avoid bias or favoritism in awarding contracts. So for example, for projects over $175,000, the city has to use a sealed bid process and accept the lowest responsible bid. Minnesota Statute 574.26 also requires public projects over $175,000 to include a payment bond. For projects where a payment bond has been obtained, subcontractors and workers can make a claim against the bond for wages that they're owed. We would request that language be added to the bill, clarifying that these new provisions would not apply when a city has required a contractor to provide a payment bond for a project. Without this clarification, there may be confusion about whether a claimant could file two claims for a payment, one from the city and one under the bond, or how those claims should be reconciled. And I'll stop there, but I do want to thank Representative Feist again for continuing to take the time to talk about our concerns. And thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much for your testimony. We appreciate the work you do for our communities. Next, Representative Feist, do you want to say anything before we go to member questions?
I could respond. Sure. So I just wanted to point out that the Department of Labor and Industry and the AG's office are supportive of this effort. They are doing their best to address wage theft and believe that this will be an important tool in addressing it in Minnesota.
Thank you. I forgot to ask if there was anyone else from the public who wanted to testify. Okay, seeing none, we'll go to member questions. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Feist. You know, I have to be honest with you. I am so tired of this conversation. I am so tired of the fact that we have such a rampant problem with wage theft that we have to continue to have this conversation. And for industry to look there and turn a blind eye and claim that it's not happening and ask why the AG isn't here to show up for certain enforcement issues, I have to be honest with you, if the AG were to show up for every wage for every time someone was disenfranchised, the AG and none of us would ever leave this room. This is ridiculous. And it is unconscionable that the industry is not doing their part to fix it. We are here today expressly because the industries and the contractors who are responsible for paying their workers are not doing it. I can tell you that I have many folks in my family who have done everything from drywall and insulation to plumbing and HVAC. And every person I can talk to has some story of being cheated. Literally everyone. This is not a one-off kind of thing or, oh, it just happens here and there. I'm sorry, Mr. Coyle, but that is not the case. This is ridiculous. Thank you, Representative Feist, for making an attempt to do something when others have not. And to the contractors and to the folks out there, to the employers, it is time for you to get your house in order and get it done. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a complex issue, and I, Representative Bonner, I really respect your viewpoint, but, you know, there are avenues. You know, the two examples that one of the testifiers brought up, DigiKey, and then the second example, I mean, everything in the second example was unlawful. And there's contractors out there that can't get paid by people. They build, they do improvements to people's houses, and those people refuse to pay them. And there's a process that they have to go through. They have to go to court in order to get money. They pre-file liens. And don't get me wrong, I agree with you. Anybody that steals money from somebody, that needs to be solved. But this is not simply, you know, born on the back and saying that, you know, most contractors are bad people. They're not. They basically put everything on the line every day to try to do a good job. This bill, and thank you, Representative Feist, for bringing this bill. I know that regardless of where it goes, you're going to continue to work on this bill, and you're going to try to make it better. I do have some concerns. Putting the liability on general contractors, I think is difficult. Even though, you know, the AG and Dolly are supportive, there is an avenue that is being unused. If there's a way that we can try to bolster that, I think it would be better. I think the biggest issue that I have with this particular approach and is that it, the workforce and subcontractors are super, it's super mobile, especially in the ones who are at risk of not being paid. You know, and so I don't know if it's going to solve the worst part of it. Maybe it will. But my biggest concern is that I think it's going to limit these small to mid-sized contractors from being able to grow in a reasonable way. And I know that you would never intend to do that. You know, I think what we really should bolster those systems that we have, wrap our arms around those people. And I have one question. Is our union, are signatory companies exempt from, they're not exempt from your bill?
Representative Feist.
So they are, actually. We have a number of exemptions. I was trying to be short in my intro comments, but I can go through those. So so projects that are engaged in a collective bargaining agreement, and we expanded that exemption, would not be subject to this bill. Projects that are subject to prevailing wage laws would not be subject to this bill. Small, single-family, and I believe two-family residential projects would be exempt from this bill, and homeowners who directly contract with subcontractors would be exempt. And the reason is that those are all scenarios where we thought that workers already had recourse, and that wage theft was unlikely to exist, and also just not to place that burden on individual homeowners.
Representative Nadeau, one follow-up. There are other members.
Yeah, I didn't know that. Thank you. I think that makes it even more difficult for me, because, you know, carving out certain I think making those carve-outs is creating an uneven playing field. You know, I think there's a real opportunity for non-signatory contractors to become signatory, and I don't know if this is. I think that this hurts that. I think this is, again, I agree and recognize and agree with what you're trying to do. I just don't think this is the path. I think. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Harder, and we are going to try to. Wrap up this morning session on time. So if you'll state your question, please.
Thank you, Chair Cleavorn. Representative Feist, I do agree that people should get paid for the work that they do. I guess I'm not aware as to how often that this happens. Do you have any data that you could share with me at some point? How often is the state dealing with complaints such as this?
Representative Feist.
Yep, thank you. Thank you for the question. So approximately 50% of construction projects have wage theft. One in five workers, or approximately 23% of workers in construction, are subjected to wage theft. So it's hugely prevalent. And I would say, you know, initially I had some talking points in my first presentation that was like, you know, the industry is set up to be susceptible to wage theft. But I don't think that's the case. I think it's, like, I understand based on conversations with stakeholders why we created this general contractor subcontractor model. And I don't think it was created for the purpose of wage theft, but I do think it is uniquely susceptible to it because we have so many of these layers. So I do feel that it is incredible, or I know it is very prevalent, and that we need to do something about it.
Representative Rogers, did you have a follow-up?
Yes, thank you. So do we know, is this concentrated in certain areas of the state, or is this statewide that we're seeing problems with this?
Representative Feist.
It's statewide.
Thank you. Representative Kosnick.
Thank you. And, you know, I was originally, you know, a couple years back, I didn't really understand what wage theft was. And I appreciate the efforts of the advocates to inform the jobs committee back then that I was on. And I supported the original bill. And I recognized the testimony that says the original bill isn't working or needs to be tweaked a little bit. But I think this bill goes too far. I also wanted to point out, we just accepted the A3 amendment. And we talked about the Attorney General being here or not being here. But the author brought forth an amendment that actually strikes the Attorney General enforcement in certain parts within the bill. And so that's helpful in some ways, but we can't sit here and say that the Attorney General, if they were, you know, they're a major statewide agency and they have people that monitor all the bills that we do here. And they chose not to be here to weigh in on this bill and apparently haven't on throughout the process. We can take the author's testimony that they are supportive of the bill, but also the author recognizes that the bill needs some work a little bit. And so I look forward to hearing what revisions you have. It is an important issue, but this bill goes a little too far. You know, one of the main issues that we have is the cost of housing, and we're trying to study and take on how do we create more affordable housing and keep housing that's not technically, you know, termed affordable, but regular market rate housing. How do we keep that cost down? As was mentioned, that we're one of the highest housing costs in the region, and this bill doesn't help that at all, unless I misunderstood something, but I'm pretty certain it does not reduce the cost of housing. And so I look forward to your continuing working with the industry partners, all of them, so that we can make sure that people are paid what they signed up for. I think that's important, and then that's noble. But this bill is heavily one-sided. And I think just the assumption of liability at the top end for the general contractors is needs a lot more work, and it's a little heavy. You know, one of the other testifiers, you know, suggested that maybe 500 or 1,000 more Dolly investigators might be needed. I think that's more of a, I don't know that that's data driven, but I think the point is fine. That could be a better approach than to put on the burden to kind of self-regulate in some ways, because I'm not sure that will necessarily work. And that is the purpose.
I'd like to let Representative Feist answer your question, if I can just ask you to wrap up.
I didn't really have a question. I'm making more of a statement about the bill, and I'm encouraging her to continue to work on it, Madam Chair. And this is the committee.
There was a question I wanted to be able to answer. You asked about the AG's office and why those lines were removed. Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So those lines were only removed because they were redundant. The AG already has enforcement authority under Chapter 181, and this is within 181, and we actually were working with them on this, and so they have been heavily involved, and they were the ones who suggested this. And should I, can I respond to others? Or
okay. Please.
And I definitely am interested in continuing to have the conversations. I think it's really important to get stakeholder input, in particular on a very technically complicated bill like this. I do feel like the status quo is one-sided in favor of industry, and we're trying to shift that balance, you know, from the people who have no control, oftentimes don't know who they're working for. Oftentimes the people they're working for control their housing. Oftentimes they have language barriers, and so currently they have no power. And we're trying to shift it to the people who do have power. But I hear you that, you know, the construction industry is a very complex industry, that a construction project is very complex with many moving pieces. And I do want to get the balance right. So I'm happy to continue to have those conversations.
And thank you, Representative Kosnick, for raising the issues that you raised. I appreciate that.
I look forward to the author continuing to work on this bill instead of jamming it through. And thank you, Madam Chair, for your time.
Thank you, Representative Kosnick. Lead Nash.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I will do my very best to keep measured, because I've heard some things that I would say were based in rampant emotionalism. But I want to address a quote from the LIUNA testifier that says, "The buck stops nowhere in construction." And I'm just going to say that's an outrageous comment. That is utterly outrageous. That is making a blanket statement on every person that works in the construction industry that is an owner or a general contractor, and that is garbage. I know a lot of these people. Some of these people are some of my closest friends. And to make that statement, sir, is outrageous. Because they do take responsibility, and many of them are unbelievably conscientious, and they go to the mat to make sure that they are doing good work. Yesterday evening, I had a conversation with my friend, Mr. Dunnick, and Mr. Dunnick knows that I advocate for the trades quite loudly, and I do work super hard to make sure that we are doing things that touch all aspects of the construction industry to make things better for the construction industry. I told him at that time that I have a lot of friends, and we have until 10 o'clock, Madam Chair. So
we have two agencies who are here also to report.
I understand.
Thank you.
But this bill is what we have in front of us.
I'm not stopping you, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a number of friends who are general contractors and subcontractors, and when I shared this bill with them and then when they brought their concerns to me, they are terrified of this, that it is a heavy-handed approach that makes subcontractors compliant with things that they would never reveal to people, potential trade secrets, employee information, and all in the name of something that all of us agree should not happen. But I would point out that what we're trying to do is pass another law when Dolly has the ability, and the author has said that already, that Dolly has the ability to enforce these laws currently. I have not heard any data from Dolly that says that there is a problem here and that this is as rampant a problem as is being alleged. And I liken it to the mentality that things are out of control from one person's perspective or a group's perspective. So let's pass more and more and more and more and more laws when we're not enforcing the ones we have already. That's equally outrageous, sir, that we're going to try to fix something when we're not enforcing the laws that we already have. However, I know in talking to a lot of my friends that they, Representative Bonner, are conscientious. And assuming that industry, and you picked on Mr. Coyle and the home builders, it is, again, outrageous to make blanket statements of that level to say that all people in construction are outrageously offensive and abusing this law. That is craziness. There is a concern on our side, and we do support making sure that wage theft does not happen. And Representative Feist, you know when I say that, I mean that. That is a concern. That is not a proper behavior. People should get paid what they agreed to get paid. But what this bill does is it brings a 20-pound sledgehammer to a finish hammer problem, in my opinion. And what we're doing is we are going to force, effectively, non-union companies to be held accountable to something that union companies are not. And I'm with Representative Nadeau on this. That makes it more problematic.
Representative Nath.
Madam Chair, I will be done in one second.
I'm just going to ask you, and I have worked in a very civil way, and I can see that passions are high on this. We are not, we as a committee are not impugning the behavior of good contractors.
Madam Chair, we did hear it from Representative Bonner, and we did hear it from Liuna.
Just say, we have been told today that 23% of workers are subjected to wage theft.
Well, Madam Chair, I would love to see that data.
That means that many more are not as well. So please, if you'll just, I just want to bring the temperature down.
I
just want to bring the temperature down.
I beg your indulgence.
We can all hear.
Because this drastically impacts many of the people who are my closest friends in the world.
But what I want you to know is that when voices rise at a table, it makes it more difficult for people to hear the important comments you want to make.
Madam Chair, I would ask you to also hold Representative Bonner to that same level of accountability because that did not happen.
I'm speaking to all members of our committee. Thank you.
I will close. I think, again, that this is a very heavy-handed approach, Representative Feist. And you and I are also friends. We've had coffee together. We've tried to find common ground on many things. I would encourage you to meet with stakeholders, including the stakeholders on this side of the aisle, because if you're asking for our vote, you're asking for us to come to the table and be stakeholders as well. I have not heard that. Representative Nadeau brought up concerns, Representative Harder, Representative Kosnick. I know Representative Joy feels similarly. Let's not go down the road of making blanket statements like the buck stops nowhere in construction and going on the assumption that every general contractor, subcontractor is a bad actor. because that's what this bill very much feels like. And I don't buy into that for one second. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Nash. And Representative Feist, I'll let you close up the bill and address whatever issues you would like with Lead Nash's comments.
Great, thank you. Representative Nash, I appreciate your comments. In response, I'd just like to make a few points. The data sharing that's part of this bill would be providing evidence of information that the parties already have shared with one another. So a general contractor already knows from the bid what the subcontractor plans to pay their workers, how much they plan to bill them out at, how many of them they have, what they'll be classified as. So that information is not secret between the parties. I just wanted to make that point because I think it is important. It was a question I had. In talking with the Department of Labor and Industry, they have said that this bill will make their job easier, that right now they do struggle to have staff to investigate wage theft, and that having access to this data will help. So I just wanted to make that point as well. The data is real, it is pervasive, and I'm happy to share it with you. And I would like to make the point, you know, one in five workers is subjected to wage theft. That's incredibly and unacceptably high, but it also means that four in five workers aren't. So I'm certainly not coming in here and saying that every contractor and subcontractor is trying to get away with something. And I do think that this bill actually levels the playing field between good actors who are doing right by their workers, who have really strong business ethics, and those who aren't good actors. So I think this is important for competition. And I think I'll leave it at that. I would be very happy to meet with you. I think that my colleagues I'm working with on this will tell you that I'm annoying about how many people I'm willing to meet with and hear out and try to work with on amendments. I think it is a really important part of this process. So I'll just close by saying this is a really important bill. We are trying to shift the balance of power. I realize that. But I think it's incredibly important. It's going to address an issue in a meaningful way that it must be addressed. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I'll request a roll call on the referral.
Oh, thank you very much. The roll call has been requested. And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 1859, as amended, be re-referred to Ways and Means. And with that, we will please take the roll.
Chair Cleavorn?
Aye.
Chair Cleavorn? Aye. Representative Hewitt?
Aye.
Representative Hewitt? Aye. Representative Nash?
No.
Representative Nash? No. Representative Bonner?
Aye.
Representative Bonner? Aye. Representative Freiberg?
Yes.
Representative Freiberg? Aye. Representative Hansen?
Aye.
Representative Hansen? Aye. Representative Harder?
No.
Representative Harder? No. Representative Herr?
Aye.
Representative Herr? Aye. Representative Joy?
No.
Representative Joy? No. Representative Kosnick?
No.
Representative Kosnick? No. Representative Nadeau?
No.
Representative Nadeau? No. Representative Newton?
Aye.
Representative Newton, aye. The ayes are 7, the nays are 5, with 1 excused.
With 7 ayes, 5 nays, and 1 excused, the motion prevails, and House File 1859, as amended, is re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Thank you. Next, we will have on our agenda the Minnesota Humanities Center. If we could have Chief Executive Officer Kevin Lindsay come forward, please. Welcome to the committee, Chief Executive Officer. If you will state your name for the record and please begin your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Kevin Lindsay, and I have the pleasure of serving as the CEO of the Minnesota Humanities Center. Appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today about our request for additional funding to support the work of the Minnesota Humanities Center. A letter has been forwarded to you. Appreciating that time is short, I will try to keep my comments here to allow my colleague from the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council to testify as well. The vision of the Minnesota Humanities Center is a just society that's curious, connected, and compassionate, curious that we come to conversations, open hearts, open minds, to authentically hear and listen to one another, connected that we see ourselves tied to a garment of mutual destiny, what impacts one impacts the other, compassion motivated beyond empathy to act, motivated beyond empathy to act with compassion. The work of the Minnesota Humanities Center requires us to meet with a wide range of individuals in all 87 counties to seek to facilitate that respective vision. We see that within education, we see that in public discourse. Our work in trying to develop third-way civics to be able to approach civics conversations in a non-polarizing work we're seeing more and more of a call for that type of work in K-12 as well as in colleges. We're now in 6 different colleges within the state of Minnesota. I was just briefly in the hall, and there was someone who approached me, and they started talking about education. I had to remind them that I was not Commissioner Jett, but they were very anxious to be able to say, how can their teachers, their administrators see their children for the value that they have as beautiful people who are going to shape the course of Minnesota going forward. I like to think that the work of the Minnesota Humanities Center and having folks to facilitate that outreach is critically important. I'd be remiss not to say, coming into the state legislature today, Insight News has a picture of Coretta Scott King for Women's History Month. And her daughter, Dr. Bernice King, is working with the Minnesota Humanities Center, coming to hopefully distribute books. It starts with me. This type of work where we have partnership with school districts, local community partners, again, to provide tools, provide education, provide books to various leaders, educational officials, community members, I think all brings us together. So we urge your support for this respective bill.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your being with us today and for your presentation. And then we will ask Shannon Jessic, is that how you say your last name? To please come forward with the Indian Affairs Council. And then we can have questions if the members have. Thank you very much. Executive Director, if you'll state your name for the record and please begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Shannon Gijic. It's an Ojibwe word that means cedar, and so I love being able to educate on our languages.
And forgive me.
I appreciate the time this morning. I had a letter too. I won't read it. I will give a very high-level overview of our agency and what we do. Mm-hmm. Currently, we have 2 statewide departments. We have a language grants department. And we receive funds through the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, the Legacy Amendment, to protect and revitalize our Ojibwe and Dakota, Minnesota's most endearing languages. We also have a cultural resource department where MIAC is charged with the protection of American Indian graves on public and private lands. And then we have myself doing the rest of the work for the agency. We also employ an assistant who that position is vacant, but we are in need of a legislative and policy director. We have not had one since 2016, and I was that person. I also shared the responsibilities of a multi-million dollar grant program, and so we are in need specifically for a full-time legislative director. We are the official liaison between the state government and tribal governments. And in the last several years, we have been working very diligently on building relationships and solidifying relationships between the tribes and the state. And with that, I'll leave it very short and leave room for questions.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the two of you and the great work that you do for our state. Members, do you have any questions or concerns about the budgets that have been brought before us and that are contained in your budget books? Representative Nadeau.
I just have one. I was reading your legislative report, and I'm just curious. You know, one of the things that you had in there was the focus on trying to provide culturally specific teachers. And how are we measuring that? I mean, I totally agree. You know, I mean, it's, and I'm just wondering how we're doing in that regard. We don't hear too much of that at least right now. And I'm just wondering how we're doing.
Thank you, Representative Nadeau. I keep wanting to call you Commissioner.
Representative, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I believe within the materials you're referring to as the Minnesota Humanities Center, just because there's two individuals up here at the table, just for clarity within the record, there is the Professional Educators Licensing Standards Board, PELSB, in which the legislature has provided money to. That facilitates recruiting and retention of teachers by local school districts, groups supporting efforts to diversify. The local school districts have reached out to us. The Minnesota Humanities Center is very fortunate to have a retreat center, and that has been efforts in which we have facilitated training for teachers, facilitated opportunities for paraprofessionals to begin thinking about how to become teachers. A lot of school districts are seeing opportunities to increase their success in reducing shortages of teachers by focusing in on paraprofessionals. And I would be remiss not to say that some of the educational work in which we provide teachers comes from our partnership with the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council in a wide variety of ways, and that has been warmly received by school districts throughout the state.
And would you like to respond as well?
I don't have a comment at this time. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Representative Noga, was there a follow-up? Thank you very much. Members, any other questions? Seeing none at this time, thank you both for being here and for your patience in waiting for us to get to you today, and for us making the error at the last meeting. I didn't realize that your office was present at that time, so I apologize.
And thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
All right, and members, with that, we are recessed until 6:30 p.m. We will come back together. Lead Nash, if I can grab you before you leave. So we are in recess until 6:30 p.m. Good evening, everyone. I'm reconvening the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee meeting for this evening of March 21st, 2023. The first bill we have up this evening is that of Representative Pinto. Chair Pinto, if you'd like to come forward, we'll be working on House File 2321. Would you like to speak to your bill first, or would you like to have the A4 adopted?
I'm inclined, Madam Chair, to have the A4 adopted, if that's okay with you. And I'm happy to describe it if you'd like, or...
Yes, if you would, please, that would be great.
Certainly, yeah. So it kind of catches up. So this bill's been heard in several committees and sort of catches up to some pieces that have been addressed in those other committees. Sections, the first page and first two pages, making sure to confirm that when there's a transfer of employees to the new agency, that they have the same protections and be in the same position as they were before, as they are in their current agencies. That's certainly within this committee's purview. There's a report that is beefed up that'll be to us, all of us, next spring, and then some languages about data practices and also appropriations and the supplemental budget request from the administration to just make sure that the amount of funding is adequate for the job. So that's the A4.
Awesome. So I will officially make the motion that the A4 be before us. Members, do you have any questions or concerns? Seeing none, all those in favor of the adoption of the A4, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposition? Hearing none, the motion prevails, and the amendment, the A4, is adopted. Now to House File 2321 as amended.
Thank you so much, Chair Claiborne and members of the committee. House File 2321 contains the administration's proposal for a Department of Children, Youth, and Families. What it really is it's a sort of spin-off of the Children and Family Services Division of DHS, for the most part, along with a couple of, along with a part of MD that works very closely with that portion of DHS, the Early Learning Services area there, and also a small office within Department of Public Safety that works on juvenile justice issues. This has been a long time coming. There have been a number of proposals through the years to do something similar to this to make sure that we're putting kids and families at the center of the budget and of our work. And so I had the One Minnesota budget in front of me, but the center of our work in our state. And I think it probably makes sense, Chair, to just have a presentation from my testifier to kind of walk through why this came together and why it's in front of us.
Thank you. And would that be Aaron Bailey?
I believe that's correct.
All right.
Oh, there we go. Yeah.
Welcome to the committee. It's good to see you. If you would please state your name for the record and begin your testimony, please.
Good evening, Chair Claiborne and members of the committee. My name is Erin Bailey, and I am the Executive Director of Minnesota's Children's Cabinet. The Children's Cabinet, housed within Minnesota Management and Budget, refers to the convening of states commissioners around children and youth. I'm excited to be here today to present this proposal to create a new cabinet-level Department of Children, Youth, and Families through a planned transition process. The proposal reimagines state government by providing an opportunity to better center children in our state government systems. I'll be presenting today with Bobby Burnham, Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Education, over the Office of Teaching and Learning, Tiki Brown, Department of Human Services Assistant Commissioner over the Children and Family Services Division. They currently oversee the programs proposed to transfer from both DHS and MDE. I'm also joined by incredible colleagues from Minute, Admin, and some other state agencies with us as well. Along with the Children's Cabinet leaders from across the enterprise, we have really co-led this decision process to propose a child-centered agency, and we've developed the scope and transition office and plan to get it right. Our presentation will include a brief background, overview of the history, and the proposal. We are excited about the moment we are in, what is possible. If we want different results for children and families, we need to do things differently. The why behind this proposal is the 1.4 million children who live in our state. One-third of these children live in lower-income families, and they are the most racially diverse age group in our state. Children are a priority in Minnesota. They are our future, and our overall competitiveness and well-being depends on their success. Yet we do not have a cabinet-level agency who has the job of focusing on this population and the challenges before them, their families, or their communities. The programs and systems that support them exist within other structures with many competing priorities. For years, and in some cases decades, we have heard from the early childhood community that there is a need for a dedicated agency. We have heard that some agencies are too big to have this focus. We have heard that young people need a clearer voice. We've heard from legislators that there needs to be a clearer front door for these services and programs. Families, local service providers, and community leaders have been asking for better coordination, for engagement, for culturally responsive programs that meet children's needs throughout their development. While the administration has doubled down on this work, listening, learning, leveraging our Children's Cabinet and its leaders to center children in decisions and improve coordination, we've had learnings from governance reports, OLA reports, cross-agency work, and other states. The case for additional alignment is clear. It's time for Minnesota to create an agency that is centered on children, similar to the governance structure of over half of our states. There's a history to build off of and learn from in Minnesota. In 1995, the legislature established the Department of Children, Family, and Learning. The department was created to replace the Department of Education. It had a broader focus and encompassed the K-12 education in its scope. In 2003, the Department of Education was reestablished and programs were distributed back to their home agencies. Yet we continue to hear from challenges lifted up by families and communities, and a 2010 task force recommended a cabinet-level Office of Early Childhood. The Office of Early Learning was created. We believe there are learnings from this. The proposal before you is different, and it is more in line with other states across the country. Over the last 4 years, our state has built an action-oriented cross-agency tables focused from prenatal to young adulthood, driving coordination and problem-solving. We've received a federal preschool development grant that started with robust engagement to develop a family-informed statewide early childhood strategic plan. These efforts and more have built for the moment of now. And with feedback and partnerships and strong alignment across our leadership team in the state, we believe that it is time to move forward across this coordinated continuum as other states are. Related to the governance of children's programs, there are three models: consolidation into new agencies, consolidation into existing agencies, or coordination. States are moving, as I said, across this more child-focused agency, some more specifically to early childhood, others with more of a whole family approach. Washington State is one consolidation model that we have examined. The state consolidated across a broader spectrum of children and family services with a law in 2017. These transitions to consolidation have streamlined focus and presented opportunities for innovative services. Recent work with MAD outlined what is needed for successful governance change, with careful attention to planning with dedicated staff and resources and time, proposed thought-out work that we have proposed in our transition office, engaging with leaders and securing buy-in, and determining funding and resources needed. Considering this, we put together this proposal for a new Department of Children, Youth, and Families with a transition process and timeline that provides the resources and time to get it right and to adapt with all of you. I'm going to transition to the specific proposal. The why, as I alluded to, the governor and lieutenant governor are proposing this new structure to enable a recognizable public face, a clear front door in the state's quest to prioritize children, increased opportunities to maximize and coordinate funding, to align outcomes, and to convene leadership, and to sharpen the focus of our current agencies. In accomplishing this why, our leaders agreed to hold principles related to a whole family approach, to consolidate early childhood programs, to ease access, and to improve equitable outcomes. The core programs and structure of the agency focuses on the elevation of Children and Family Services Division at DHS, combined with the Early Learning Services Division and Youth Investments from the Department of Education and the Department of Public Safety. The list of core programs for transfer was thoughtfully identified with a focus on consolidation of child care and early learning programs, family-focused community programs, economic support and food assistance programs, and youth opportunity and older youth investments. The bill language obtains the necessary authorities to establish and operate this new agency. With a two-year transition team in place, a new commissioner on July 1 of 2024, and a transfer of core programs over the next year beginning on that date. None of this is immediate on July 1 of 2024, and the bill language and existing authorities allow for adjustments to the core programs, which I will speak more specifically to just a second. The bill funds an implementation team and a transition fund, obtaining authorities and resources to support the creation, alignment, and launch of a two-year process. The transition office will be established on July 1 of this year and will be responsible for leading the establishment of the new agency and planning for the transition of programs to it, including elements related to budget, finance, legal, human resources, IT, and many other functions. The governor's revised budget recommends $2.3 million in fiscal years 24 and 25 and just more than $7 million in fiscal years 26 and 27 to support the creation starting on July 1 of 24. The funds will be used for an implementation team and transition fund over the next 2 years, direct expenses at the Department of Human Services to prepare for the new agency, and a new executive team. For reference, here is more detail on the programs moving from the Department of Human Services. They're listed in Section 15, Subdivision 2 of the bill. As Chair Pinto said, this includes the entire Children and Family Services Department, with the exception of certain housing grants and administration programs within the Economic Assistance and Employment Supports Division. The proposal also includes licensing and program integrity functions from the Office of Inspector General at the Department of Human Services for child care and related CFS programs. From education, the programs proposed to move are all those under the Early Learning Services Division, as well as an after-school grant program. The Office of Youth Justice from the Department of Public Safety aligned with the focus to move upstream, focus on prevention and youth supports. I'm going to end by stating the obvious. This proposal seeks to answer questions and feedback heard for years from families in Minnesota. But in order to do it right, we need a robust engagement process. We need more specific discussions with families, local service providers, including schools, tribes, and others, counties, and others. And the way to do that is through dedicated time and capacity. And that time is now. When we have a network of leaders who are ready to engage, believing that this exercise is important for our state. I'll now pass it on to some of those leaders. First, Assistant Commissioner Burnham to speak about the impact of the proposal.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee, and if you'll state your name for the record and begin your testimony, please.
Good evening, Chair Cleavorn and committee members. My name is Bobby Burnham, and I serve as the Assistant Commissioner for the Office of Teaching and Learning at the Minnesota Department of Education. After years of working both inside and outside of government, mostly focused on the goal to ensure coordination and access to early care and learning programs that support successful transitions into the K-12 system, I am thrilled we are at this point of proposing a child-focused agency with a key principle being consolidation and coordination of early childhood programs. Through recent efforts funded by the legislature and administrative efforts like the Race to the Top grant, the Early Childhood Systems Reform effort, the OLA report on early childhood, and most recently the work of the Children's Cabinet and the Preschool Development Grant, the state has made significant progress in coordinating and aligning early childhood programs. And we've heard the needs related to the governance shift. Through these efforts and engagement, We believe in building on our progress by consolidating early childhood programs, resulting in improved outcomes for children, families, and the workforce, improved coordination for providers, aligned funding prioritization, and a common application or front door for families. We look forward to continuing to engage our community members, educators, and program administrators in this process and the transition. I want to acknowledge that we have received feedback from our early childhood special education partners regarding the transition of one of their programs, Part C. Part C is listed as a core service that would move to the new agency under the proposal. This would change the state-level agency responsible for the state-level administration of Part C from the Department of Education to the new agency. This does not change Part C administration at the local level. We are not proposing any changes to how these services are currently delivered or who delivers them. Creating a new state agency with the purpose of better aligning programs will not change a district's collective bargaining agreements, and the amendment presented today helps address that. There is no proposed language that would change who is defined as the service providers for Part C. We've made significant progress for better coordination in our early childhood system, and we believe shifting governance of programs will build on that progress to improve service delivery, support the workforce, and, most importantly, better ensure our young children thrive. Now I will pass this to Assistant Commissioner Brown to speak about additional opportunities with this proposal. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And welcome, Assistant Commissioner Brown, if you'll state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Cleavorn and members. My name is Tiki Brown, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services at the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Having worked at the within state government for over 20 years, one lesson I've learned is that for a population or an initiative to be a high priority, it needs a clear champion and a shared vision, especially when it comes to cross-program or cross-agency coordination. The opportunity before us to establish this new agency and provide transformative funding to advance opportunities and equity for children and families is an opportunity to make a positive impact for generations to come. We are in a unique moment where leadership is aligned around centering children in their decision making and genuinely believe that this new agency will provide sustainability of funding for the state to prioritize children and their families. Leaders with significant experience both inside and outside of state government in running effective programs, change management, and driving outcomes and progress are supportive and ready for this change. DHS takes equity and outcomes for children very seriously. And often the structure and competing priorities prevent the prioritization and representation needed to elevate the needs of children and families internally within the agency, at the legislature, and with our community partners. A new agency would sharpen the focus on children and the work of DHS itself. Specifically, the Department of Children, Youth, and Families will enable the creation of a sustainable central state vision to ensure Minnesota families are able to reach their full potential. The agency will provide the leadership and coordination needed to support children and families by valuing and implementing research-based multi-generation approaches, focusing services for adults who play key roles in the lives of children as a source of meaningful, equitable impact. It will prioritize economic and food assistance programs so every child has access to culturally relevant opportunities to help them learn, grow, and thrive. It will provide coordinated implementation of a unified statewide network of community resource centers. This agency also includes creating the structure needed not only to maintain our IT systems that support essential children and family programs, but the authority, collaboration, and leadership structure to transform these systems in an ongoing way to ensure that technology enables coordination of services, whole family, whole child approaches, while making programs easier to operate for our local government and community partners. We know that transitioning our systems into this new structure will be challenging, And we know from experience in cross-agency IT projects that consolidation and prioritization are essential to programs. Including the full spectrum of age groups of children also means that we prioritize youth and focus on upstream connections with youth rather than costly downstream public safety and corrections. Combined with the historic funding decision before us, this new structure is timely. The Department of Children, Youth, and Families will be uniquely positioned to support the historic investments for children, youth, and families that the governor has proposed. We have the opportunity to boldly act in this moment, leading on previous engagement, research, and work that other states have done. Because our state depends on the success of Minnesota children, youth, and families. The creation of a new agency can achieve a clear front door and recognizable public face, improve communication outlets that focus on children and their families, coordinated and maximized funding, aligned outcomes for children and families, and improved access to services. We have a plan to take our time, do it right, and continue to listen and engage with agency staff, our tribal and county partners, and our families. Combined with significant investment in children and families, this new department will create a shift that Minnesota needs to ensure that equitable outcomes for children occur from birth to young adulthood. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Chair Pinto, do you have any other testifiers there?
I don't believe so. I think there's a member of the community member who's going to testify, but maybe it was on from a public side.
I have two members.
Okay, I guess. Learning my own testimonies.
If you please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Yes, good evening. My name is Teresa Barr, and I am the owner and director of Early Advantage Developmental Child Care Center in Byron. I'm excited to be here and share how transformational a Department of Children, Youth, and Families would be for me, my families, my teachers, and every child I serve at my center. I've been in this industry for over 15 years, and navigating all the systems we're expected to in an increasingly financially strapped industry has grown worse and worse each year. It has become nearly unbearable. The hassle of working with so many different organizations simply to complete the work of providing early childhood education is daunting. Just for collecting tuition payments, we have to work up to with 8 different agencies. Every child that lives in a different county means we have to work with that specific county to get child care assistance reimbursements. Then if they are getting scholarships or funding through any other source, we have to go through each of those different sources. In DHS alone, we engage with many parts of the department, including background studies, child care assistance, licensing, multiple counties to collect payments, parent aware and develop, as well as the Department of Health, DEED, and the Department of Education. If we have a child with special needs, we might work with another handful of organizations, such as Help Me Grow, an education district, such as ZED, a local school district, the Center for Inclusive Child Care, and outside therapy services. I counted the number of different organizations my program works with just to provide basic services to our children, families, and staff, and I quickly came up with over 20 organizations. The point is, it takes a lot of time and money to navigate all these different systems. In our program, and I would imagine many others in the state of Minnesota, it takes multiple full-time employees to manage, connect, and communicate through all these systems. If even half of this was placed into one department, imagine how much time and stress that would save providers, who would then be able to actually focus on providing high-quality child care and supporting their teachers. Yes, this comes with a small cost, but the cost of the continuous decrease in providers across the state of Minnesota is multitudes greater. We already have a workforce shortage in Minnesota. With an ever-increasingly challenging system, we will continue to see providers decide it's just not worth it. As the number of providers continues to decrease throughout the state, how is that going to help parents with young children be able to go to work? We love what we do. We want to continue the important work we do, but the headaches and struggles and frustrations that are brought on by the web of agencies we must navigate are relentless. Please create a new department that keeps children, families, and providers at the forefront. Creating this would be a transformational way to streamline decision-making power in our system, allow us to have a permanent seat at the table when it comes to state budgets, and ensure high-quality programs are under one roof in Minnesota. So I hope you hear our plea and help our industry not only survive, but to thrive.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Thank We're you. Very appreciative of your being with us this evening. Thank you. Members, I don't see any additional amendments. We will go to member discussion.
I don't know if there's a public testimony, Madam Chair, but I...
I don't see the other person who's here, who is on the list. So pardon thank you very much.
Pardon me, Madam Chair.
That's all right. Members, Representative Harder.
Thank you, Chair Claiborne. Representative Pinto, I just have a couple of questions. So as a former county commissioner, I know frequently that things change at the state and the impact that it has at the county level, because I do hear from the workers. I don't know if this question is for you or maybe for one of the department heads. Will the counties see any kind of a savings, whether it's their local levy or a streamline of services that benefits the workers at the county level?
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Chair. And actually, when I was asking about the public testifier, the person I had in mind is from Association of Minnesota Counties. So I wonder, she may be able to provide, shed at least a little bit of light on that, or at least the perspective, county perspective on the proposal, and answer your question as well with the Chair's permission. And I'm not sure if that's, but she may be able to provide county information.
I will say this to everybody who's here tonight. I know this is an important topic, and we're all very focused on making sure that we do it well and do it right. We have a full agenda this evening, so I want to make sure that we answer the questions fully, but also move on to the other pieces of legislation we have with us.
It may be, Chair, then it may be that somebody from the administration may be a better source than me to answer that question about county savings.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Bailey.
Chair Cleaverne and members of the committee. I'm not sure that we know that yet. I think we are having really important doubt. There is a lot of important dialogue that is necessary with the counties. Would love your perspective as a former commissioner as well. And we have a meeting, even several meetings this week coming up with counties. I don't know that we can speak to knowing exactly the budgetary impact for counties at this point.
Thank you very much. Representative, one more, please. Yeah. Okay. Representative Harder.
Yes, that'd be great to know more about that. The other question that I have, and I'm not sure if it really pertains to this, but many counties use the nurse family partnership. And will this have any impact on that delivery of services?
Please proceed.
Yeah, Chair Claiborne, Representative. That program is not specifically included listening core services. I did touch on the existing authorities, and the language allows for a process for additional programs based on that feedback and that transition time. But that would not be specifically included in this proposal.
All right. Thank you. Thank
you. Lead Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to either the author or the testifier. I know that there are employees that are in multiple places that are likely to go to this new entity. And I'm hoping, Chair Pinto, I'm hoping that as we do that, we're gonna have sort of a map or a chart as to who goes where and how is salary carried from one place to the next and reapportioned. And it's going to be a lot, I'm sure. So I'm hoping you can allay any potential fear that we might have as to how are you doing that? Have you done that, or is that something yet to be determined? Because what I'm hoping does not happen is that we take a quarter of a person away, as I know we do sometimes, and then leave it behind, and that just is going to wind up growing our budget even more than the forecast that we got today is growing our budget. So please help us understand that.
Chair Pinto.
Ms. Bailey.
Ms. Bailey.
Yeah, Chair Cleaverne, Representative Nash, thank you for the question. This is why we've planned for a thoughtful process and transition time. I think I speak on behalf of all my colleagues here to say that we share that goal and prioritization, certainly thinking about staff and leaders and how essential they are and making sure that we create that space. Obviously, that sort of unwinding and planning is complicated with staff, and we need to get that right and not leave sort of fractions of FTEs. I will say the legislative language includes specific employee protections, and we've built that in partnership with our leaders and conversations with the unions to make sure that we get that right.
And Madam Chair.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the author, I guess, are there, because I think there's some federal money interaction that goes on here, is there, have you thought about allowances if that money is not appropriated again at the federal level? Because as we all know, the feds can be a little, you know, unpredictable, unreliable might be a good word as well. What happens to the funding that comes from the feds if that goes away for this program?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, Representative Nash. So I guess the proposal itself is not conditioned on federal funds. So the programs that will be transferred, some of them do, or some of them have heavy interaction with federal funds, but that would be true, absolutely. But that'll be true whether they would remain in the current agencies or move to the new agency. So that shouldn't have an impact on that in terms of the, you know, I mean, either way, we'd be in the same boat in that way. But either way, we want to make sure the programs interacting with one another as effectively as possible, and that's the idea of being the new agency.
And Madam Chair, just very, very briefly.
Last one. Please,
that, but you're creating a whole new agency, and that's sort of like when I talk to people about relying on LGA. It's a very ephemeral thing, and if you build a budget predicated on something that is or could be considered ephemeral, and then that does actually go away, the new agency is left holding the bag, and are we going to potentially cut things at the agency or jettison that? I mean, I think you understand where I'm going with this, that federal money may evaporate, which may put this new agency that is thoughtfully being put together, according to you, what happens if that goes away? And I know that if it happened when they were separated, there's impact, but now you're building a whole new agency with people and a commissioner and, you know, rental space and building space and all of the things that go into it. But if that money disappears, I'm sure that problems ensue that you may not be anticipating from what I'm hearing.
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, Representative Nash. And maybe this is worthy of longer conversation because I'm still trying to have my head catch up on a little bit. I mean, you know, there are significant federal funds in this, as there are a number of parts of the budget, but there are very significant state funds, you know, state funding to this as well. And even if the federal funds go away, we still have to protect children, child protection. We still need to do the work of the different parts of this agency either way. And so I think there'll still be a great value in having programs that relate to these areas be in the same agency. But again, I'm very happy to continue this conversation because I had not really thought of it that way before you raised it, and I'd like to continue.
Thank you. And Representative Vice Chair Hewitt, did you have a question?
I didn't have a question, Madam Chair, but I do have a statement. Representative Pinto, I want to thank you for all the hard work that you've done, the governor's office and the agency and the council that have put this work together, as I am starting a very similar course to what you've done with another situation that we need to look at. I can understand the hard work that you and your team have put into this, and so I really appreciate that, and I look forward to supporting you as you get closer to the final subject here.
Thank you. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Pinto. I think you know that I am a big fan inside the IT world and out of people-centered design. And, you know, it also is no surprise to a lot of you in this room that I have been very passionate about early childhood endeavors and development. And, you know, I think that one of the things that struck me when I first came to the legislature and started, particularly in the early childhood space, is that it often felt very fragmented. It felt like the focus was all over the place, and it was not always where it should be on the children and the families that we should be serving. These are our future Minnesotans. They are our future economic engine. They are our future business owners, our future workers, our future families, our future moms and dads. And so I really love the idea of this and putting a new lens where that is specifically focused on children and specifically focused on those families to really be able to have a more person-centered approach. And so for that reason, I just want to thank you for bringing this proposal forward. No doubt, as we've alluded to here today, it will not be an easy endeavor. It'll take some work and lots of hard deliberation. But if the goal is here, again, to get those children at the center of that lens, I think it's worth it. Thank you for that.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. And Executive Director, I thank you for being with us this evening. Chair Pinto, I'll let you close up, and then I'll renew the motion for the bill.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, and thanks, Chair, for your time and expertise that you brought to this, and thanks for the discussion to all. It's a big endeavor, I think a worthy one, and certainly be eager to have your support. Thank you, Chair.
And with that, I will move that House File 2321, as amended, be re-referred to Children and Families Finance and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
The motion prevails, and you are on your way to Children and Families.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members. Thank you.
Next, we will have an informational hearing. Representative Kraft. And I'm just going to ask the people who are moving in the audience to please do so quietly as you possibly can. Thank you. Representative Kraft, welcome to the committee. We are here to discuss House File 2677. If you would keep it short and concise and awesome, that would be wonderful.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Great to be here. I want to provide a little global context to this, because yesterday the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change put out a pretty important report, and I'm quoting from it, said that human activities, principally through emissions of greenhouse gases, have unequivocally caused global warming. Global greenhouse gas emissions have continued to rise, with unequal historical and ongoing contributions arising from unsustainable energy use, land use, and land use change, and that's my emphasis there. The other thing that it says is that climate change is a threat to human well-being and planetary health, and there is a rapidly closing window of opportunity to secure a livable and sustainable future for all. The situation requires us at all levels of government to think differently and build climate considerations into all our systems, all our existing systems. So I'm happy to be sharing House File 2677 to this committee. Thank you for the informational hearing. Appears things got a little backed up after this was re-referred, which is why we don't have the here to you right now. This bill is especially focused at our transportation emissions, which is now the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in the state. The bill seeks to translate our statewide greenhouse gas emission targets into the transportation sector and recognizes that in order to reduce transportation emissions long term, land use is a, if not the, critical component. So a brief summary of the sections of the bill. Article 1, Section 1 is where we have MnDOT that will be required to establish benchmarks for statewide greenhouse gas emission reductions and allocate them across the transportation sector, with a special call out to the metropolitan area. In Article 1, Section 2 will require the Met Council to create a regional climate action plan with a special focus on land use and vehicle miles traveled, and then embed climate components into comprehensive plan content so that they can be part of the next comprehensive plan cycle. Amendment language coming will make it clear that no standalone climate action plan will be required, and based on input from Met Council and Metro Cities, will remove the overly prescriptive nature of the current language so it can fit within the existing comprehensive planning process. Article 2 requires the Met Council to conduct a land use study so results can be included in the next round of comprehensive plans. The study is about how land use and transportation policies interact relative to environmental, greenhouse gas emission, and equity goals. And finally, in Article 3 is where these greenhouse gas emission targets from the Article 1, Section 1 from MnDOT are put into action. And it requires MnDOT to consider greenhouse gas emission targets as they undertake capacity expansion projects. It's not so much the purview of this committee, but I tell you just to have the full picture. With that, I will pass it over to my testifier.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record and begin your testimony, please.
Very good. Thank you, Chair Cleburne and Representative Kraft and members of the committee. My name is Sam Rockwell. I am Executive Director of MOVE Minnesota, and I also teach courses on both land use regulation and transportation policy at the University of Minnesota's Humphrey School and Urban Studies program. So this bill is right at the intersection of my interests. As you know, and as Representative Kraft stated, transportation persistently remains the highest greenhouse gas emitting sector in the state of Minnesota, and in fact across the United States. And transportation sustainability requires that Minnesota both electrify and reduce vehicle miles traveled. which means how much we drive. And reducing vehicle miles traveled requires strategies that bridge transportation policy and land use planning, because how much we drive is influenced by the shape of our community land uses just as much as it's influenced by our transportation networks. So right now, Minnesota has statewide goals to reduce both greenhouse gas emissions and vehicle miles traveled. But these reduction targets are just goals. And this bill before you today creates a structure for actually meeting those goals. In effect, this bill is about bringing accountability to the promises the state has already made to Minnesotans. The portion of the bill before this committee will ensure we understand how transportation and land use impacts greenhouse gas reductions, and it will establish a clear path to reducing greenhouse gas emissions and VMT in the metro, and importantly, the comprehensive plan structure that Representative Kraft mentions this year will be this time around will be targeting 2050, a particularly important year in that Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change framework. It will also infuse climate considerations into local land use planning so that local community efforts and programs are coordinated with neighboring jurisdictions and across the region. The emissions impacts of land use and transportation are intertwined, as are their joint impacts on access to opportunity, family and municipal pocketbooks, health, and more. The bill brings land use and transportation planning together in service of an environmentally and financially sustainable and equitable future for all Minnesotans, and in service of keeping the promises our state has already made to its citizens. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And we do have another testifier here this evening, Patricia Nauman, if you'd like to come forward. Welcome, Executive Director. It's nice to have you with us again.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
If you'll state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Happy to do that. Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for the opportunity to speak to you this evening. My name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities, and Metro Cities does represent the collective interests of cities in the metropolitan area at the legislature, executive branch, and also the Metropolitan Council. So the association does take a very keen interest and has a lot of nexus with the work of the Metropolitan Council. I appreciate certainly the interest by Representative Kraft in this issue, and Metro Cities have certainly worked with Representative Kraft when he was a city official, and we know of his passion and interest on climate change and issues. So Metro Cities does have concerns with the legislation. We have been talking about those concerns, and I just maybe would like to outline the fact that the language would be set under the Land Use Planning Act, which is in law, and it's fairly broad. It's not very specific. It doesn't tend to list really prescriptive or specific requirements. The concern that we have is that by setting prescriptive requirements under that Land Use Planning Act, it does set more or less a one-size-fits-all mandate for metropolitan area cities with respect to their local plans, and would basically impede potentially the work that does go on between the regional government and local governments with respect to addressing the needs and circumstances of individual cities with respect to any comp plan requirements that are basically determined every 10 years during the regional planning cycle. So we are concerned again that by having a pretty prescriptive mandate under that Land Use Planning Act, it would upend those regional and local processes that are currently underway and underway every 10 years. So I just want to also note that local plans are submitted to the Metropolitan Councils for the purpose of ensuring, you know, the Metropolitan Council's role is to ensure the orderly growth of the region. Local comprehensive plans must be consistent, basically must be consistent and conform for regional systems, for the provision of regional systems such as wastewater and transit. One of the concerns that we have is that by putting the climate resiliency content under the Land Use Planning Act, it essentially potentially sets up climate action plans as a regional policy or a regional system. And Metro City's policies are very explicit in the need for any system to be pretty fully vetted and have an established funding source and really fully considered before that occurs. Again, I just maybe want to finally note, Madam Chair and members, that regional requirements are determined in collaboration with city officials so that local capacities and needs can be accounted for. Over 76 cities in the last round of comp plans did include a climate resiliency plan or content in their plans without any state or regional requirement. And So I know that might not be enough for, it's basically half the cities. I just maybe would further note that a lot of work is underway between, you know, the Metropolitan Council and city governments in terms of setting up requirements for the next round of plans, and we'd certainly be happy to have further conversation about how cities and the council can work toward these goals more directly. So I will leave it there, Madam Chair, members, and I appreciate your time this evening.
Thank you very much. We always appreciate your testimony. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, we can move to, we can take a few questions. It's an informational hearing. Members, do you have any questions that you'd like to ask? Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll start. I've got a couple of questions. So this bill is really targeted towards the metro. And thank you, Representative Kraft, for bringing the bill. Thank you for having a conversation with me yesterday on the floor. I appreciate, you know, your willingness to engage in conversation on this, and I know that you're passionate about this topic, and I hope to be helpful, I guess. So this bill is very targeted towards the metro. And just in Article 1, can you tell me what the target reduction in greenhouse gases would be that you would be shooting for? Is it you want to decrease it by 50%, 100%? So number one, what is the target that the benchmarks, you know, that are kind of in line 1.11 are referring to? And what other options would a metro have? You're an expert in this. And what other options would a metropolitan region have to reduce greenhouse gas emissions?
Representative Kraft.
Madam Chair, Representative Nadeau. It's irrelevant what I would want. What the bill says is what the state has already adopted and committed to, right? And so on the books right now is the Next Generation Energy Act from 2007, which says we need to reduce our emissions 80% by 2050. There are some other bills here to accelerate that, which I support, but this does not state here are the goals that you must do. The states reference what the state has already committed to. So then your next question was, what would it mean? What would be the, I think the, what would be options for the metro area? I'll also say, I should also back up a little bit. There's a part of the bill, the MnDOT part of the bill actually seeks to take those emission targets on a transportation level and feather them out around the state based on which region, with some acknowledgement to there may be some places that have more ability to reduce emissions than others. Places with more density have more ability to do that. Within the metro area, in terms of what kinds of things a city or the region can do, well, it's pretty much anything you can think of, you know, broadly on climate, you know, renewable energy, energy efficiency, waste, dealing with waste better. On the transportation side, certainly things like electrification, land use, how we set up our systems to make it easier to not always use a car. Also things like...
Representative Kraft, yeah. If I can just ask you to pause there.
Sure.
Do you have a follow-up, Representative Nadeau?
I do.
All right, I will let you go to your follow-up question, and then I'm going to ask you to keep your answers concise because we have two more bills we still need to get through. Representative Nadeau.
And thank you, Representative Kraft. I thought that's where you were going to go, and I appreciate that. And the metro area has done an enormous amount of work using CIP funding, using grants, putting solar panels, building bikeways. I mean, created all kinds of opportunities to reduce mm-hmm. that. And so what I was ultimately wondering if you were trying to, get to an 80% reduction from, 2007 or an 80% reduction from today. And I get it that maybe this will be addressed later. So I'm going to move on to my second and follow-up question. We'll let that one sit, and we can talk about that one later. It has to do primarily with Article 2 is land use. The Met Council is a bit of an anomaly right now with the things. I mean, what it started out doing 50 years ago was fantastic. It was meeting the needs of a growing region. With wastewater, with developing parklands, and then it kind of, it solved many of those things, created a MUSA line, really provided some fiscal disparity reductions with tax capacity sharing. all good things. And then all of a sudden, you know, in kind of in 1976.
Representative Nadeau.
Yep.
We're not debating the Met Council. Is there a question to Article 2?
Yep. Yeah. Thank you. Article 2 is all about the Met Council.
I realize that, but is there a specific part of the bill that you're questioning?
I'm questioning how the Met Council, in 2015, the Met Council did something similar. They did it with a housing plan. They basically came up with, with some goals and some things for all the communities to meet. And the problem with it was there wasn't any money. There wasn't any money. So we identified this issue, and we identified the Met Council and community spent an enormous amount of money trying to figure out how to deal with it. And so I want to know how this is going to actually be effective. It wasn't effective with the housing plan development, and I'm wondering how you would change it so that the climate action planning done by the Met Council through the system statements forced on to, this is a mandate, mandated onto local units of government, would implement effective climate action planning.
Thank you. Representative Kraft.
Madam Chair, so I'm not familiar with the 2015, so I can't speak to that. What I can say is that by having clear target system level approach that the Met Council creates, and then giving them the flexibility to work in their comprehensive planning process to build that in the manner they see fit, we've taken out the prescriptive language. It's a process that has worked on the comprehensive planning process for decades, and so we're plugging into that in a way that we think is have the maximum impact.
Thank you. Representative Costner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and there's a lot that we could go in on this, but just a couple quick questions since it's an informational hearing. Mm-hmm. Number one is the cost. If you could talk a little bit about the fiscal note. I know that a lot of the cost is absorbed, but those are still costs that we could potentially recognize and put additional burdens.
Is there something specific in the fiscal note you would like?
Yes, on page 3, line 4, the total cost absorbed just to the council is over $4 million.
Representative Kraft.
Madam Chair, but you said that's an absorbed cost, which means it's stuff that they're doing already.
Thank you. Representative Kosner.
Well, then to one of the testifier, Ms. Naumann's point is we kind of don't need this because it's already being done. But it's still, if you think differently, those are still actual cost and time of current employees that are going to be drawn off of other missions that we have them do. But kind of a little bit to Representative Nadeau's point of the effectiveness of this and doing all these planning and requirements and working at it, let's say you realize the goal of your intent, however you would measure that. There was a comment made about coordinating with other jurisdictions and that. There's a lot of people in this world. Even if you met your goals, I would question how much would it really change climate change? And do you have the power to make Wisconsin go along with this, Iowa, all the regions, other countries? And so sometimes we get well-intentioned on this, and I wonder if it actually would actually make much of a difference in the end.
Thank you, Representative Kosnick. We'll go to Lead Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And there's a lot here, but I will be brief. And I'll first point out that Ms. Naumann and I don't always agree on everything, but I have tremendous concerns on this. And a lot of it comes from being a mayor previously and having gone through the painful effort of doing a comprehensive plan with the Met Council. At the time, they said, well, Mayor Nash, we're seeing that Waconia is going to constrict in growth by the time your next comprehensive plan is growing, and that was completely not factual. And when I pointed out to them that we were growing, they said, oh, we'll pencil whip our model for you. So I have grave concerns over the developments of models. And what I look at in your Subdivision 2 in the land use plan, Representative Nadeau actually stole some of my thunder. In 2015, they did a land use study for housing, and We are now in a metro and statewide housing crisis, in large part, in some part, due to that. So when you're dealing with as many cities in the metro area as this bill would prescribe that you do, you are now either going to go over the top of other elected bodies and force them to do something, or you're going to have tremendous pushback like they got from the city of Waconia on things when I was mayor. So that's my one concern. Second concern is that we are putting a tremendous amount of faith in an organization that has made several really big OLA reports as showing that they have no ability to provide oversight on something that is of a humongous nature. This is, while it's a handful of pages, this is an amazingly consequential bill that you put forward, and I have zero faith that they would be able to get this done. Given that this is informational only,
please,
I'm going to hold my fire until such time that it comes back. But this is so cumbersome when you realize how many interacting parts there are that make up the cities that are in the metro area. I'm a watch collector. I love looking at the different pieces of going into the watch. All of those little pieces that you see in a watch are kind of like the cities in our metro area. They all have to work together very, very well. And on something like this, it's not. So you may have people in the downtown area that are overjoyed and potentially very encouraged by this. I live almost at the terminal end of the seven-county metro area where the Met Council, and we don't subscribe necessarily to everything that's being proposed here. The comprehensive plan is an adoption of concerns also from cities. We're not hearing the cities' voices. Ms. Nauman provided some concerns. I'm sure the League of Minnesota Cities would provide concerns as well. This is disturbing, and then I will be done.
Thank you very much. Representative Kraft, we are very glad that you were with us this evening and that you brought your bill forward. Would you like to leave us with some closing comments, please?
I'll be brief.
Those are the most dreaded words from a representative, just so you know. Just a little levity. Thank you.
So thank you for hearing the bill. I believe we have heard some of the comments from Metro Cities and have addressed those in the next revision you will see. That said, I do have faith that this is the correct, and I disagree with you on these things. And I will also say that if everyone took the attitude that, boy, we can't address a tough problem because they're not, then we would never make progress. I prefer to be much more positive in my thinking. Thank you.
And I appreciate your commitment to our climate, and I appreciate your commitment to our state. Thank you for being with us this
evening.
Thank you. Next on the agenda, we have House File. Let's
see. We have you.
We have me. All right. And we will do House File 2427, the Capitol area.
Chair Cleborne, please move your bill.
Thank you very much. I move House File 2427 to be re-referred to the Economic Development, Finance, and Policy Committee.
Chair, I see you have an amendment.
I do have an amendment.
Could you please move it and tell us about it, please?
Okay. Excuse me, just one moment. May I approach?
Oh, sorry. You need your paperwork?
I realized I picked up the bill, but I didn't pick up my notes. Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, it's great to be with you this evening. I'm just going to do a little bit of background, and then I'm going to hand over the testimony to Executive Secretary. So the Capital Area Architecture and Planning Board.
Chair, do you want to move your amendments first?
All right, I can do that. Thank you very much. We'll move to the A3.
Go ahead and tell us about it.
I move the A3 be before the committee. A3 amendment, it refers to the Ford building and the site redevelopment. And this amendment requires the Commissioner of Administration to prepare and approve building construction plans for the redevelopment of the Ford building. But it must have plans for mixed-use development and identify ground-level space for locally owned businesses. That's the key component of this amendment.
Are there any discussions to this amendment? Representative Doe.
I just have one question. If the city of St. Paul doesn't want mixed-use development there, I mean, I'm just curious. I don't know anything about how this works.
What I'd like to do just a moment is go back. And before we really dig into the A3 or the bill, just give a little brief background on what the CAP board is. I think it'll be very helpful to the committee because many people don't know what the CAP board is.
Chair, go ahead.
Would you like to?
Yeah, I was going to tell you.
We're going to do things in a little bit of a different order, so if you'll just help us.
It's your committee.
Okay, thank you. It's our committee. Yeah.
Can you let me know if you're able to see a slide up there? Thank you.
Yeah.
This threw me last time, and you can't see my talking points, right?
No.
Okay.
Perfect. Thank you. I'm Merritt Clapp-Smith, and I'm the Executive Secretary for the Capital Area Architecture and Planning Board. The CAP board roles and responsibilities are shown to you on this slide. We are a board of 12 members, and we have oversight of 60 blocks called the capital area. The CAP board oversees planning, land uses, and design of public and private spaces and projects. The capital area has its own comprehensive plan as well. We don't have to file it with the Met Council.
Okay, let's go.
We're going to change that.
We don't need to bring that up.
You need to deal with that.
Okay, now if we can bring a little bit of order back to this now. So the underlying bill itself is for the Capitol campus design framework. So it is going to be allowing them to put a Capitol complex framework together. The A3 amendment deals with one of the buildings that will be in this district area, and that is the Ford building, which is an abandoned building across the street of University Avenue. And so it says, notwithstanding any law to the contrary, the Commissioner of Administration may not prepare or approve building construction plans for redevelopment of the Ford building unless the plans are for mixed-use development and identify ground level space for locally owned business. That's the sum total of the amendment.
That was your A3. Representative Meadow, before I call on Representative Nash, did you get what you needed?
That was perfect. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Nash, for your go ahead.
And I'm going to try to help the chair here just to add some clarity. The state owns the Ford building.
The state does own the Ford
which was
building.
Not may not be known by everybody. So the state is owning that. My question to the A3 mm-hmm. is you want to develop the ground level for locally owned businesses.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be as a rental relationship, or what's the proposal for that? So if you're developing it for locally owned businesses, who is the state the landlord, and how does that get done? Is there a joint powers agreement that has to be done with just maybe help us out with how that would work.
Chair Cleburne?
To executive secretaries.
Yeah, thank you for that question. Most likely it would be a lease from the state. In unique circumstances, buildings can be condoized, and so you can have a portion that has one owner and a portion that has a different one, but the expectation is that it would be a lease from the state.
Lee Nash, follow-up?
No, well, I like the building. I wish that it wasn't empty for decades, I believe. It's kind of pretty from the outside. But I am encouraged that we're looking at that, and I'm very familiar with the Capital Area because I serve on the Capital Area Security Commission. And I think that redevelopment of that is good. And I hope that we can make the businesses work. And it's a very European model to have businesses on the lower level and then have other things going above it. So I think it's an interesting use and would love to know. I'm sure you'll get to the cost of all this. So
we will.
That'd be great.
So hearing no more discussion on the A3, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? The ayes have it. The A3 is adopted. Madam Chair, you have a A4 amendment.
We do have the A4 amendment, and somewhat in conjunction with the A3, this is a Capital Area Community Vitality Task Force. And this task force would be established to look at, so the purpose of the task force, let's just go to that for just a moment. The duties of the task force must consider and develop recommendations for the administration, program plan, and oversight of the Capital Area Community Vitality Account, which will be established also in this amendment. And it will report back recommendations to the Capital Area Architecture Planning Board, to the chairs and the ranking minority members of the committees of the legislature. And so it is to look at the how we make this area economically vivacious, I guess is the right word to use. And that is what the A3 will do. It is putting together a community vitality task force. And the appropriation, since I know that will be asked, is $5 million, and it will be established by a special revenue fund appropriated to the Commissioner of Administration. The CAP board will the task force itself will have $150,000 to do its work, and then what their recommendations would be done out of the special revenue fund, and that is the A4.
Lead Nash.
It just about fell the last time, so. Madam Chair, $5 million appropriation, you're going to back $150,000 out of that for the board of the task force. What does the balance go to?
Thank you, Chair Hewitt. It's not a balance, it's an and. There are two different numbers. That would be for the work that is out, comes from the recommendations of the task force.
Lead Nash, follow up.
In a way that it sounded kind of circular, and I'm not saying that it was purposely circular, but I'm trying to figure out what is the $5 million going to get us? Is it going to be blueprints? Is it going to be design work? Mm-hmm. Is it going to be architectural stuff? I didn't hear what that is. I'd really like to know before I might actually vote for a bill that spends $5 million bucks. I'd like to know what a guy gets for $5 million nowadays.
$5,150,000. May we please move to Executive Secretary Klapsmith.
Secretary?
Thank you. The $5 million probably would focus primarily on capital investments in buildings and properties to improve them. It could also be used for improvement of public space, art, community efforts, possibly housing efforts, but it would all be focused within the capital area. So it's really a local and community economic development program to really improve the health of this community and its attractiveness. I mean, that it's a great place for the community and also a great place for people who are at the capital.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and then I'll try to be done. So serving on the Capital Area Security Board, I know that we have many plans that are in place for security improvements. Is this in conjunction with those who are designing those things so that you might come up with an idea and you begin moving it in a direction, but it's in conflict with some of the security initiatives that we've undertaken there to make the entire campus, which is a very large area, more secure? So I'm just trying to figure that out because I believe that there could be some competitive initiatives that are undergoing consideration in this as to what we've done for the last, now 9 years, trying to get our campus more secure.
Yeah, that's a great question.
Secretary?
Sorry. You're good.
Okay, I'm learning too.
You're great.
It's a good question. Addressing safety in the area is going to be one of the key parts of what the task force looks at. And we will be talking to all sorts of stakeholders. And so certainly coordinating with you and other efforts around campus security is going to be really important. I'm a big believer in not duplicating work and trying to collaborate and make things more efficient. So we'll definitely be working with you as the task force to make sure that ideas you have are being advanced and coordinated with things that would be happening in the larger Capital area.
Lead Nash, if I may move to the amendment adopted.
I'll just say I'm refreshed that we oftentimes don't hear we don't want to duplicate things in government. So that's a nice concept.
So all those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
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 All opposed? The ayes have it. The amendment is adopted. Chair Cleburne, to your bill in the shape it is.
To 2427 as amended, I would I'm just going to ask Ms. Executive Secretary Clapp-Smith to go through her presentation, and then I think it'll help us as we talk about the bill as a whole. So if you'd like to just continue on with your presentation.
Secretary?
We've got our shtick down. So the Capital Campus Design Framework update introduced in House File 2427 by Representative Cleburne. It's also in the governor's revised budget. Cass Gilbert's vision for the Minnesota Capitol focused on the Capitol building as a center point for the city, framed by large green spaces connected to neighborhoods in all directions and providing direct vistas from near and far. Over time, the campus plan has been updated as the city developed and redeveloped. But we've kept the tradition of a central lawn and connected open space. The most recent plan is 32 years old and desperately in need of update. Planning for maintaining the Capitol campus that is attractive and inviting requires analysis of its functions and elements and how they interact. This diagram shows the primary layers of information that will be gathered and then examined by a multidisciplinary consultant team. A great Capitol Mall is built for its users, and public engagement will be central part of the planning work. We will ask things like, what do people like here and how can it be improved? Does the Capitol Mall attract people from 8 to 80 years old and every age in between, and other questions? Some people say that plans are meant to sit on shelves, but this one is not. It'll be written as an implementation manual with activities, roles, and resource needs clearly identified. One of the very first implementation activities will be the planting of trees. The bill also anticipates and identifies relocation of open spaces for public activity. The state office building addition encroaches into Leif Erickson Park, displacing park space and its traditional function as a space for civic expression. Under statute, the CAP board must work to protect and enhance open space, essentially a no-net loss policy. The bill suggests two new open spaces to be created on state land at the northeast and southwest corners of University and Rice. And we just covered the two recent amendments, the Capital Area Community Vitality Task Force to improve livability, economic health, and safety of communities in the Capital Area. And the task force will work with economic development consultants and talk to community members, community development organizations, safety specialists, and research successful example from places similar to the Capital Area. And we discussed the Ford building. I just wanted to clarify that this is about the Ford building site and really adjacent lot, double A as well. There is contemplation that the whole area will be redeveloped with a new building. The Ford building is currently proposed for demolition and funding is being sought for that. So this really envisions a new building that would be in that place. That's it.
Thank you. Chair Cleburne, is there any other comments from you, or should I call up anyone in the audience at this point?
I don't know of any other testifiers for that bill.
This is a public hearing. Is there anyone that would like to testify on this? Seeing none, hearing none, member questions. Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Chair Cleburne. It was an interesting bill. With a couple of the amendments, there was a lot of $5 million project in here, but where do I start here? I guess I would start first off. So a couple of years back, when I was a freshman, first-term legislator, before that, they passed a $300 million renovation to the Capitol and a lot of the work in front of the Capitol. Mm-hmm. Was some of this just not included in that, kind of an afterthought or a second phase? Because when we talk about this, and this obviously comes with a cost, the taxpayers and constituents are going to want to know, what's the interaction with that so I can explain it to them? So was it an afterthought? Obviously, the Ford building is a separate project. Or is this a next phase? Was this planned? Or are we just adding on?
Sure, Gleeporn.
I would ask Executive Secretary Clapp-Smith.
Thank you. Improvements to the Capitol building and landscaping in areas around it, that was based on principles from the 32-year-old plan. This would be an update of that plan so that any future projects, both within the open space or buildings adjacent to that, would then use that updated plan as a guide for investments. But these investments, they would apply throughout the mall, adjacent open spaces, immediately adjacent to the campus itself. So it's really a very comprehensive study to guide those future investments.
Follow-up, Representative Kosnick?
Yeah, a couple things. So there is a comprehensive guideline, and I think that's important to this area. It's a beautiful campus, and there are some challenges with it. Mm-hmm. And so I think you're addressing, the Ford building and some of the challenges around there. Does the comprehensive plan, what is with the neighboring property of the Sears building, and how does that interact? Because I don't see that on here either, and obviously that's been vacant building for, I think, almost 2 years now. Can you share with that and why that's not included in here, or if it's not, which I don't think it is, what is the plan for that?
Madam Secretary?
Yes, thank you. The Sears property is for sale. It's been marketed by Seritage, and perhaps in the coming months we will hear whether or not there's a new buyer. The development and public infrastructure that goes in there will probably be a combination of public and private. Typically, the city would consider tools that it might use to assist with public infrastructure. Whether the state wants to contemplate helping with that site is a future decision. So this capital area fund isn't at this point envisioned as being used in any significant way to support the Sears site redevelopment, but there could be small elements that sort of connect that site to the community that would be part of it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then just kind of follow up, it's a critical site as we take a look at redoing this building, which didn't get a lot of public input. But there's an interaction there, and I think there's possibly a missed opportunity. You talked about the Leif Erickson Park area and preserving that park space. On 9.1.19, it talks about visual markers and such. One of the visual markers that a lot of people had interest in was the Columbus statue that was on the other end of the mall. Are there plans to reincorporate that somewhere?
Excuse me.
Representative Chair Cleburne, I think you might want to take that.
Yeah, I am going to take this one. We're not going to go down that path tonight. We're talking about comprehensive planning. We're talking about a capital work framework. We're talking about the contents of this bill. And we're talking about creating a space for those discussions to be held at a later time. So we're not going to go down the pathway of the Columbus statue tonight.
Any other questions? Representative Rajol.
I just want to make sure that I understand this right. So on line 1.14 of the original...
Representative Newdall, can you pull the microphone?
Yep, sorry. I just want to make sure that I am understanding this right. On line 1.14 and then on 1.16, it's basically a half an acre on the southwest corner of Rice and University on the other side, correct? South, okay. And then on 1.16, it's a half acre on the northeast corner, which is where the Ford building, that parking lot is, right? Half an acre there. Okay.
The records show that the witness said yes.
Yes.
The testifier. The testifier.
Sorry.
I'm just curious as to, and then the rest of it is basically, which I think is great. You know, we're gonna build this shade canopy. I think it'll be wonderful. I'm just curious those two parcels. Why those two parcels, and especially on the other side of Rice Street.
Secretary Clapson, you're up.
Yes, thank you. The kind of no net loss policy that came into discussion early this year. The Speaker of the House and other leadership and staff at admin closely read our comprehensive plan for that area, the Capitol Rice area, and recognized that the displacement of open space had to be covered in some manner as part of the state office building project, and those were areas that were proposed because they're both owned by the state. And the idea was that they perhaps could be small areas for kind of welcoming, gateway, interpretive signage about the community itself, about the Capitol, and then on the northeast side, that space would then be complemented by that ground floor mixed use, so that you don't just have some odd little space, but it actually is sort of going from public to quasi-public private to the building itself. So that was the rationale, but ideally we would have had more time to figure out the space, but it's kind of connected to the rezoning of the state office building.
Representative Nadeau, a follow-up? Or?
Nope, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Seeing no other, Representative Bonner.
Just a really quick question, because I think maybe I lost track somewhere in the discussion here. So the Ford building, we are keeping the building and repurposing the space with businesses underneath, or we are demolishing the building and building a new building?
Secretary Clapsmith?
Yeah.
Go ahead, please.
Mm-hmm. The Department of Administration has a request for funding for demolition of the Ford building, and I believe that's being reviewed this legislative session.
Representative Bonner?
Just a curiosity question, because I'm curious. Do we know how we came to the decision of demolition versus restoration and repurposing? Just curious.
Representative Cleburne.
Representative Bonner, that was done prior to this legislative year, that decision, and we can get back to you on how that was done.
Wonderful. Seeing no other questions on the committee, all those in favor? We have to renew your motion.
Renew my motion that House File 2427, as amended, be re-referred to the Economic Development, Finance, and Policy Committee.
I should have let you close, too. All right. Okay. All those in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed? On your way you go.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. I hope you.
Chair Cleburne. Please move your bill.
The next file before us is House File 2940, which is the governor's budget bill. And I refer my motion is to refer House File 2940 to be re-referred to Ways and Means. And this is going to be a staff review of the bill. And so I would ask that our House nonpartisan researchers, Matt Gehring and Chelsea Griffin, walk through the bill. And my question is, do you want to stay where you are, or would you rather sit here? What would you prefer?
Well, they're moving their mics. Please identify yourself for the committee and continue with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, Matt Gehring from House Research. I would probably stay here, and I think I might defer to Ms.
Roberts to start with the appropriation part.
Ms. Roberts.
Madam Chair, can I just ask a clarifying question about level of detail that you want in the walkthrough?
No, I think we can just go through. Everybody's had an opportunity to review it. It's been posted. It was posted on time, and it's been there. So if we can just do a high-level walkthrough, and there will be a DE at a later time.
Ms. Roberts.
Madam Chair and members, I don't think you probably want me to walk through each appropriation. I do have a spreadsheet that I will get to the committee tomorrow, which I think is an easier way to look at appropriations. But just in general, the governor's bill includes appropriations for the legislative branch, for the constitutional officers, and then a number of smaller agencies. You'll see some, for example, this bill has the Campaign Finance Board in it, but as you know, that is actually under the jurisdiction of the Elections Committee. Also included are the appropriations for some of the major administrative agencies, MINIT, MMB, Administration, and the Department of Revenue. And that gets you probably through about page 13. Also included are appropriations for the Gambling Control Board and the Racing Commission. And then again, the ethnic councils, some of the occupational licensing councils, the Historical Society and Humanities Commission. And so that's just sort of a really high-level overview of somebody. If anybody has questions, I'm available. Again, I will have a spreadsheet that I think will lay this out more clearly for you.
Thank you, Mrs. Roberts. The next part?
Mr. Chair, then the next article of the bill is Article 2, the policy language, starts on page 19. And I think instead of going section by section, I'll just say generally that these are all the policy items that are included in the governor's budget request. And many of these sections, including Section 1, come from bills that you've seen previously. So Section 1 is part of the new department from Representative Pinto's bill that the committee has already heard. Section 4 on page 21, there's a series of sections that amend the process for the existing compensation council to establish salaries for state constitutional officers as well as agency heads. The change here would, instead of requiring the council to make recommendations, the council would actually prescribe salaries that would be mandated by statute. So there's a series of sections that include that change running through Section 9. And then there's, starting on page 24, sections 10 through, sections 10 kind of through the rest of this article, I'd say page 28 and 29 are all sections that are within Department of Administration provisions that the committee has seen previously as part of their technical bill. Highlight on page 33, section 28, which is a section that this committee hasn't seen before, grants for cybersecurity to county and local governments. And there's, again, going forward in this article, a series of these sections that come from Representative Pinto's bill to create the new Department of Children, Youth, and Families. Starting on page 38, there's a long series of sections related to the way that Department of Administration and state archaeologists interact with cemetery sites in the state. This is language that the committee has seen in previous biennials, and but is new to this particular year in this committee. On page 45, there's a Office of Small Agency Studies that this committee has really heard previously from the Department of Administration. And then sections 37, 38, and 39 to close out Article 2 are sort of fiscal transfers and cancellations that relate to the work of agencies within the jurisdiction of this committee. And then Article 3 is the governor's proposal for dealing with the stadium reserve from U.S. Bank Stadium, and that is the entirety of Article 3. And then after Article 3 is the series of repealers that you see that align with the rest of the policy of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Guerin. Madam Chair, do you have More?
Mm-hmm. Is there anything Ms. Griffin would like to say?
Mr. Chair and members, no, there aren't any sections that I was planning on highlighting for you.
Great. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair.
And with that, members, this is just a high-level overview of the governor's recommendations. Most of these items were contained in the binders that you have had with you all year, except for the new one that Mr. Gehring spelled out for us today. And with that, I would just ask for your support in moving this to Ways and Means, and then we will be coming back to committee to discuss the author's my bill. This is the governor's recommendations, and then we will put together our state government finance committee bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I see we have two testifiers.
And if you'd call them forward, please.
Kristen Swanson and on deck, Peter, I'm not saying your name, sorry. And if you could state your name for the record and start your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Hewitt, and thank you, Chair Cleavorn and members. My name is Kristen Swanson. I'm a development officer with Minnesota Public Radio. I'm here to talk about line 10.31 of the bill. This is a request for $1.02 million for Minnesota Public Radio for an equipment grant. Thank you to the committee for our current funding of that same amount. And thank you to the governor for including our request in this bill. These funds help support MPR's infrastructure to provide the backbone of the emergency alert and Amber Alert systems, offsetting some of the system's expenses. With more than 80 stations and translators across the state, MPR signal reaches 95% of the state. All of Minnesota's radio, television, and cable broadcasters, more than 300, rely on and monitor MPR's radio network 24 hours a day. Our staff works with these media partners to ensure the system is operating correctly and troubleshooting when problems arise. We know if our equipment fails, all of those other systems are affected. Our staff also provides other supports for the system, including sitting on the Integrated Public Alert and Warning System Board with state and local officials to continue to improve the EAS system. But none of the state funding we receive goes to any staff salaries for this work. Funding goes only to our Greater Minnesota radio equipment and only to that which is essential to the EAS and Amber Alert systems. We have a flat funding request because we carefully assessed our needs over the next 2 years and planned equipment upgrades and replacements that we could accomplish in that time period. And it's true that this specialized equipment has not seen the kind of inflation that some other equipment has seen. We budgeted for exactly what we need without any extra. Each year, this funding is split between planned projects and emergency repairs. A winter like this one can be really hard on equipment. I've seen pictures of our housing for our equipment that has holes in it from icicles falling on it. And our infrastructure is now more than 30 years old. MPR matches the state funds we receive. The overall cost for the upgrades to the system over the next 2 years is double our request, not including the staff time involved in maintaining the network. MPR is proud to make this contribution to the safety of all Minnesotans, and we hope that you will fully fund our request to make sure it is ready when we all need it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Swanson. Peter Botak, I'm going to go for it.
Hey, welcome.
Please state your name for the record and your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Peter Whitehawk with Hunger Solutions, very close, with Hunger Solutions Minnesota. I appreciate the opportunity. I'm just going to highlight the Healthy Eating Here at Home grant, known more widely as the Market Bucks program. So this is the Farmers Market Nutrition Incentive Program that SNAP customers are able to stretch their purchasing power at over 100 markets across the state. We appreciate the inclusion of an increase in funding of $50,000 per year in the governor's budget. We, however, are concerned that at $375,000 per year may be insufficient to effectively run the program due to the rising need and also the popularity of Market Bucks across the state. And that's why we worked on a bill this session that would increase that funding to $500,000 per year. which passed out of the Senate State Government Committee, and we would encourage support for that bill as well here in this committee. So Market Bucks customers, the last thing I'll say is just Market Bucks customers have really come to count on this program to help them afford fresh, healthy food that they want to be able to improve the health of their families, but also for seniors, many seniors across the state that depend on this program, especially right now as food insecurity and food shop visits have skyrocketed across the state. So we urge your support once again for this investment so we can continue to improve the health of our residents and feed people across the state. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Mr. Wytok. This is a public hearing. Is there anyone else wishing to testify on this? Seeing none, we will move to member discussion. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, those two testifiers actually covered a couple of things that I wanted to talk about. I am grateful to see that public radio is included for the Amber Alerts in this bill. I think it's Representative Freiberg's language that I am a co-author on, because it is an incredibly valuable and essential tool for the dissemination of both emergency alerts and Amber Alerts. I think I shared in committee what seems like forever ago that I was on a boat in the middle of a lake in the middle of nowhere and got an Amber Alert, and I thought that was fantastic. But that doesn't happen if the great work of what's going on there is not seen with some updated equipment, because that's something that everybody gets pushed to their phone. So I think that's really important, and Madam Chair, I hope that we keep that in the bill. So I'm very, very supportive of that, and I think that that's just a good expenditure of public funds to make sure that for weather alerts and Amber Alerts that we are indeed alerted to. Secondly, the Market Bucks program, and I had reached out to you earlier today talking about my support of that, and for those that were on the committee a while ago, we actually fought to keep it in the budget. It was actually being considered to be removed, and a number of myself and my colleagues on our side fought to keep it in because I got to see that in action. And I will continue to fight for it to stay in. I oftentimes attend the St. Paul on University, some of the farmers markets there, and I get to see people actually using this, and it's pretty cool. I think that if we can move away from prepackaged foods and preprocessed foods and show people what it's like to buy things, and sometimes if you go to those farmers markets, you see things that you've never seen before, or in my case, I like making my own hot peppers, and I ate one of the peppers that was there. I don't recommend always doing that sight unseen. You might want to ask questions about it, but the Market Bucks program is incredibly useful for the people in our state. If we are going to do those sorts of things, then I fully support its inclusion in the State Government Finance Omnibus Bill, because I have seen firsthand that folks the last time I was at that market, there was a mom and had two kids, and they were walking by, and I think she was letting them pick out something that they were going to buy, and it looked like it was based on how vibrant a color the food was, and I thought that was great, because now you get to see a young child dip their toe in the water of some new foods that are literally picked the day before, most likely, and Madam Chair, I really hope that we keep these two provisions that I've talked about in the bill, because we support it wholeheartedly. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. And I'll just speak to the Market Bucks program. Well, both of these initiatives are in, have been heard in the Senate. And as everyone knows, it's not always easy to hear every bill in both bodies. So sometimes we try to divide and move forward together at the conference committee. The Market Bucks program, I just want to make sure that we're all clear about it. There was not an attempt to ever eliminate Market Bucks. It was to move it into the agriculture and food budget. And because that committee at that time had the word food in it, and so that was the motion to move it. And it is remaining in state government. It has remained in state government. And I, like you, have supported it for the last 4 years as well. So I would just say that about that. And with that, I would renew my motion, Mr. Chair, that House File 2490 be re-referred to Ways and Means.
Madam Chair, the governor's bill will be sent to Ways and Means. Not yet, though. We have to vote on it. Sorry. Trying to push it. All those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? The ayes have it. It's on its way to Ways and Means. Amendments for the policy omnibus bill are due by noon tomorrow. The finance omnibus bill will be heard next week. With that said, members, we are adjourned. Our next meeting will be Thursday, March 23rd, 2023. We are adjourned.